You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Welcome to the best of Flashpoints for the week of September 11th, 2015. My name is Mike Biggs. Today we bring you a report on outrageous new claims that exposure to low-level nuclear radiation is actually good for you. Then we'll feature an in-depth look at the U.S. nuke deal with Iran. Finally, the story of an Israeli nuclear whistleblower interviewed for the first time on Israeli media. All this straight ahead on the best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview from Tuesday's program. Dennis spoke with Professor Carl Grossman about the outrageous new claims that exposure to low-level nuclear radiation is actually good for you. Listen to this.
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I'm thinking, has an extraordinary amount of forgetfulness going on, or they've gone crazy. They want to make sure that what? We get impacted by more low-level radiation? You want to talk about this?
Yeah, well, there's a petition now by three nuclear folks, as Michael Marriott, who is the president of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, says, a group of pro-nuclear fanatics. There is really no other way to describe them. But in any case, these nuclear folks want the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to eliminate what's been the basis for radiation protection for decades in this country, and in fact around the world. It's called the linear no threshold standard, and to adopt something that the nuclear folks concocted decades ago, which has been discredited and discredited and discredited. It's called the hormesis theory, the radiation hormesis theory. And it holds that actually low amounts of low doses of radioactivity, it's good for you. It activates the immune system.
It's good for you. It's good. Seriously, they're saying it's good for you?
It's good for you. It's healthy. It's we all need these low doses of radioactivity, and it's good for life. In fact, just the opposite is true. It's deadly. And in fact, this threshold standard was adopted, we go way back into the 1950s, after the Manhattan Project, after the crash program to build atomic bombs, suddenly people were at Los Alamos National Laboratory in Oak Ridge and so forth, working with a lot of radioactivity. And what they determined was that there seemed to be a threshold below which people didn't suffer from various illnesses, particularly cancer, as a result of radioactivity. When you get a lot of radioactivity, even in moderate amounts, that's a problem, they acknowledge, these nuclear folk. But low levels seem to be okay. What they hadn't figured on, and to give them benefit of the doubt, they probably couldn't, because what's involved here with low-level doses of radioactivity is what's called the incubation or latency period. In other words, the body absorbs the radioactivity, but it takes a number of years, from 5 to 40 years, before that radioactivity kicks back with cancer and other illnesses and diseases. So when this was discovered in the 50s, it was realized that, no, any amount of radioactivity is bad. Any amount of radioactivity could injure and kill. And they adopted what's called the linear no threshold basis of radiation protection for low doses. And that's been the standard for many years. Now, these nuclear folk would like to have the U.S. adopt the hormesis theory. Forget about the threshold. Even forget about low doses leaving bodies in the gutter, killing instantly. What they're claiming is that it's good for you. Reminds me a bit, actually, of way back when I was a kid, actually. The tobacco industry would wheel out doctors who would claim that various cigarettes were preferable. I recall one ad for camels, that doctors preferred camels and so forth. In other words, selling these cancer sticks with a pitch that, by having the doctors in the ads, that somehow there's a connection to good health. It's the same sort of a crazy and deceitful and murderous trip.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about this. You and I both know, added on to all that you just laid out, is the fact that this stuff is cumulative, so that it builds up. It never disappears, but the more you take in, the more impact it has. You want it to win. And there's been extensive research. I'm blanking on the doctor's name out here, but there's been a great deal of research on the impact of low-level radiation and its cumulative impacts.
What these petitioners from the nuclear establishment would have us ignore is that investigating groups one after the other, investigating agencies one after the other, have concluded that any amount of radiation can, as I say, injure and kill people, particularly with cancer. This includes the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, the International Commission. I'm just reading a list from the article I wrote in, this is Counterpunch. People could see the piece I wrote in Counterpunch, headed, it's on the website, counterpunch.org, radiation is good for you and other tall tales of the nuclear industry. And we have a long, long list of the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Ionizing Radiation, the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurement. And look, the list goes on and on. All these groups, after studies, after research, concluding, that, one, there's no threshold. Any amount of radiation is dangerous. And, the hormesis theory is just absolute baloney.
Why would people be pushing this at this time? What would people gain by pushing this kind of nonsense that is extremely dangerous as well?
Well, there's a variety of motives, I say, in terms of nuclear cleanup. Like, for example, where I live on Long Island, there's a place called Brookhaven National Laboratory. And as with almost all the national nuclear laboratories, it's a Superfund site because it's leaked tritium, radioactive tritium, into the groundwater of Long Island. Big problem. And what they've been doing now for over a decade is pumping the water from the site of Brookhaven Lab within the lab. It's going to keep it moving within the lab so it doesn't move towards communities near Brookhaven Lab. Well, if it could be claimed that tritium, it's low doses of tritium, that's true. But that these low doses of tritium don't represent any kind of hazard, then they can forget about all this pumping process that has been going on. And in other areas where you have a nuclear mess, same kind of thing could occur. We don't have to clean it up because it's not going to hurt anybody. In fact, it's good for you. In terms of evacuation zones around nuclear plants, take near where you are, Diablo Canyon. If they could argue that... if there was an accident, which is frankly quite likely to happen in terms of any nuclear plants in the United States at those two Diablo Canyon plants, right adjacent to a major earthquake fall, the low levels of radioactivity that would be discharged, no worry, it'll make the people in that area of California healthier, it could be argued. You can go on and on. I teach a course at SUNY O. Westbury in environmental journalism, and the text that I use, it's a great standard, is by John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton. I'm sure, Dennis, you know the book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You.
Yes.
And in the book, there's the story of some PR firm that is representing an entity that is producing a lot of toxic sludge, figures out a good campaign to represent, to defend its client would be to claim... And not that the toxic sludge is not going to hurt you, but toxic sludge is good for you. And that's the title of the book. So it kind of this isn't that new. As I note, the tobacco industry was into baloney about cigarettes and health. And here is the toxic sludge if it is good for you campaign. Now we have, though we've had this for a few times. I mean, the hormesis claim, the hormesis hoax, basically, has arisen before, and it has been dismissed. But these days, you take the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as it's currently constituted, and as bad as the NRC has been through the decades, essentially a booster agency of the nuclear establishment, the NRC has never denied a construction or operating license for any nuclear power plant anywhere, anytime in the U.S., as bad as it's been, now it's just horrible. I mean,
what has the Nuclear Regulatory Commission weighed in on this one yet? Have they made
it? Well, it's considering it. In fact, if any of the listeners, and I hope listeners do this, want to send in their comments about this cockamamie scheme, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is taking comments up till November 19th. So you have till November 19th to send in a comment. And on the website of Counterpunch, in my story, is the link to if you want to use snail mail, if you want to use regular mail, this is much, much simpler. Just write to Secretary, U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Washington, D.C., 20555. Attention, rulemakings and adjudication staff, and mention in the letter, this is the code for the for this case, 20150057. In other words, write down NRC 20150057. So the NRC is taking comments, and one thing that could maybe sway the Nuclear Regulatory Commission from accepting these petitions and changing and this is a fundamental changing these standards would be it receiving a lot of comments. So again, I would urge listeners to send a note to the NRC with what you think of this this plan. Here's nuclear news, what it has to say, and I report this in the story. The switch would be the most significant and alarming change to U.S. federal policy on nuclear radiation. We're talking a big deal, and just talking about a few people at the NRC. Currently, there's four commissioners of the NRC. Maybe by November, there'll be five. That's what they're supposed to have, five. And they're going to make this decision, which is it'll impact on everybody.
You know, it's very interesting, the timing here. By the way, we're speaking with Dr. Carl Grossman. He's a professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. The timing here is very interesting, Carl, because there is a major effective battle in terms of shutting down the remaining nukes in the U.S. You mentioned Diablo Canyon. The battle is continuing there, and the activists have been quite successful. We note that, for instance, Germany has essentially on their way to almost dropping all nukes. There is a lot of support for this. So it seems like this is sort of one of those last legs effort to reverse history.
Yeah, it's kind of like a battle of the nuclear bulge. It's a counterattack. I mean, we're down now in this country to 99 nuclear plants, and because they're not economical. I mean, they never were, but now they're outrageously uneconomical. So there's talk of going down from 99 to 89 to 79 in relatively short order. I mean, nuclear can't compete with safe, clean, renewable energy sources like solar and wind, particularly, and energy we can live with. And plants have been, in recent times, shut down. And as you know, Germany is committed to 100% renewable energy. And I note that in California, The state is talking about 50% renewable, not 100%, but it's still a big chunk. So nuclear, by any kind of logical basis, should be it's dirty and it's dangerous and expensive, and it should be out the door. So this is a kind of a gasp to I'll try to salvage the issue to make. I'm also thinking now of taking a drive through France and on the cooling towers of one of the nuclear plants that we passed was a huge picture of a smiling baby. In other words, they were attempting to humanize nuclear power in that way, to make it a friendlier technology.
And babies love plutonium. Kids for plutonium, yeah.
Well, France, incidentally, too, is turning its back now on nuclear, and France had really been heavily committed to nuclear power. So, again, toxic sludge is good for you. Plutonium is good for you. Radioactivity is good for you. I mean, these nuclear Pinocchios are just unbelievable. And it's important that we, well, like the folks around Diablo Canyon have for years, been working to shut them down, to stop this toxic industry from continuing. And in this situation, there is a bit of an opening with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. NRC, no real concerns, though, that could stand for. But still, I think letters, emails to the NRC could be helpful on this hormesis baloney.
Listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of September 11th, 2015. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature an interview from Wednesday's program with investigative journalist and author Gareth Porter, who gives us an in-depth look at the U.S. nuke deal with Iran.
Let's start with an update. Where is the deal now? It's in the U.S. Senate. Give us a little of the background. What's going on here?
Well, it is in the Senate. The vote can happen any day now. It is imminent. And, the vote is now absolutely dead certain that the effort by the Israeli lobby to defeat the agreement will fail. There's no longer much tension around that issue, if any. But what is now the last gasp, if you will, of the effort to defeat the agreement is going to be a piece of legislation that will be offered separately from the vote on the agreement itself. It is billed as an Iran Oversight Act, and it contains a series of poison pills, as you might expect, because it was drafted by AIPAC, the same people who've been really guiding the congressional effort to defeat the agreement all along. And, for example,
that's the Israeli lobby we're talking about, AIPAC.
Yes, exactly. The poison pills include a provision that would strip the president of the authority to waive the sanctions so that they can be lifted under the agreement, as well as reauthorization of a series of sanctions which otherwise would expire in the coming months or years. And so this is the kind of thing that is now going to be tried. I'm quite sure that it will fail, but the hope here, of course, on the part of the lobby is that there will be some senators who are not attentive enough, and they won't understand what they're being asked to sign on to, being assured that, oh, yes, this is simply a way of making sure that there's strict adherence to the letter of the agreement. And, of course, that's a total lie. But that's the last gasp, and that will come sometime in the next week or so.
Say something about the power of the lobby. You say they defined this resistance. They're behind it in the Senate. We saw that Charlie Schumer, a key senator with great power in the Senate from New York, has come out against this. Is he a senator from Israel? How does this work with the lobby?
Well, you know, he obviously has very, very close ties to the people who are determined to defeat the agreement, more so than other senators. But, you know, another senator who is going to be the key to this piece of legislation that I just described a moment ago, which is being billed as a congressional oversight act, is Ben Cardin of Maryland, Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. And he also has extremely close ties to those in the Jewish community who are determined to defeat this. But, I mean, the general law of politics that appears to reign in this issue is that most of the senators, including most Jewish members of Congress, are still voting a partisan vote to support the president of their own party. And I think that that also reflects the reality in this country that most Jewish voters still vote Democratic. They are not going to line up with a proposal which is clearly identified with the extreme right and the Republican Party. So I think that's a large part of, I should say, that's the main dynamic that appears to have been at work in this vote.
How much money is spent to get this the way the Israelis want it? How much money? I'm just trying to get
I have not seen
or just a grasp of the power. Yeah.
Yeah, I've not seen updated figures, but the figure that was being reported a few weeks ago was $20 to $40 million that was being used specifically by the front organization that was created for the specific purpose of trying to defeat this this agreement. And that, therefore, does not include all of the spending by a number of other organizations which are clearly committed to this and which continue to work, have continued to work for many months towards that end. So the total clearly is several tens of millions of dollars that has been spent.
Two senators.
Or was going to be
spent. To buy the Senate.
That's exactly right. To buy the Senate and the House. This includes, of course, both senators and members of Congress who were going to be needed to try to defeat it. They'd have to defeat it in both houses.
I see. All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Gareth Porter. Gareth Porter is an investigative journalist and author of Manufactured Crisis, the Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And he writes brilliantly for the Middle East Eye. Let's take a look at how this deal came about. You write in your new piece all about this, behind the scenes, how the U.S. and Iran reached their landmark deal. And you say that things went very quickly at first, that the Obama administration was really on track. Describe that, and then let's talk about what happened then.
Yes. Well, I mean, what is not generally understood, because it was not covered by the mainstream news media, is that in the initial days, that is the first week or so, in fact, less than the first week of the final round of negotiations in Vienna, which I did cover on the spot for 2 weeks there, the United States delegation really took a series of steps which were quite decisive to ensure that the deal was going to be sealed. And part of that series of steps was to assure, I would say the single most important step that was taken was to assure Iran very specifically to commit the U.S. to lifting sanctions immediately upon the completion by Iran of its part of the bargain, that is, the series of steps that were to be taken by Iran with regard to limiting its nuclear program, but also that this step would be taken on a day that was to be called the initiation day for the agreement. In other words, it was a clever use of wording to meet the political requirement that had been imposed by the Supreme Leader of Iran, which was that the lifting of sanctions was to take place on the very first day of the execution of the agreement. And so the Americans came up with this formula, and the Iranians said, fine, we'll take that. And as part of that agreement, I should add, very important to the Iranian side, as I was told by Iranian diplomats there in Vienna, is that the U.S. not only said they would promise to lift sanctions, but then committed the U.S. to take a series of steps to actually make that meaningful by talking to banks, financial institutions, various business organizations, to instruct them on what was being done and the fact that the sanctions regime was really being ended. So that was one of the reasons why the Iranians knew that there was a real momentum here towards a final agreement. And in addition to that, they also made a deal with Iran, which was very far-reaching in its effect, which basically told the Director General of the IAEA, Amano, that he was to definitely settle up with Iran. He was not to hold up the lifting of sanctions by fiddling around with the issue of so-called possible military dimensions. That is the accusation that Iran had, in fact, carried out some nuclear weapons work of some sort. He was to issue a final assessment which would not hold up the implementation of the rest of the agreement. And that's exactly what we can see has happened since then. There was an agreement between Iran and the IAEA, a very strict timetable for completing the process. That was exactly what the Iranians had been waiting for all along, to turn over all this information that they had been waiting to turn over to the IAEA until they had a final agreement on how when this process would terminate. And we now know it will terminate in December.
So it's moving along nicely. Things are moving apace. But then the administration, Obama administration, hardens the line, and you suggest slowed down the progress. What happened?
Well, two things happened in the final week or so of the negotiations. One is that the Obama administration clearly was maneuvering to demonstrate to the very pro-Israeli news media that it was not, as had been charged in various places, such as Politico magazine, that both Obama and Kerry, and particularly Kerry, were more interested in getting an agreement by a certain date, that is July 9th, than they were in getting a really tough agreement, a very strong agreement. And so in order to basically push back against that accusation in the news media, the decision was clearly made in the White House that they would not try to get an agreement by midnight of July 9th. So that was important. It had been important to the administration up to that moment that the decision was made, because that meant if they could meet that deadline of midnight July 9th, that meant that Congress would vote on the agreement before the August recess. And that would mean that the lobby, the Israeli lobby, would have much less time to try to propagandize and use all of that money to change the minds of legislators. And that's what the White House was concerned with. But in the end, they felt such political heat, such political pressure from the news media and, of course, from the lobby, that they decided to slow it down and not even try to meet that deadline. And the Iranians told me that in the last couple of days, there was very little going on. On July 9th, for example, I was told that Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, only met with Kerry for like half an hour. And meanwhile, on the same day, the United States was meeting with its own allies for hours. So that was just an indication of just how much the process of negotiating the final bits of the agreement was slowed down, so that they could meet that that political requirement, as it was viewed by the White House, to not be accused of having reached an agreement on a deadline at the cost of getting what we needed.
And that's when we began to sort of hear this language from Kerry about it's tough, it's tougher, not sure, it could be impossible. You know, all this language that, really, I guess, threw some gasoline on the people who were opposing it.
Well, I think, generally speaking, particularly in the final days of the negotiation, there was a lot of posturing by the White House to suggest that the United States was pushing very hard, that the Iranians were resisting, but we were pushing them really hard. And that as I suggest in the conclusion to my very long piece in The Nation magazine, the real problem, the real adversary, if you will, that the Obama administration and John Kerry were wrestling with in the final days of negotiation was not the Iranians at all. It was the people who were opposed to the agreement and to the news media who were reflecting to a great extent the viewpoint of the lobby.
All right. What can you give us a sense of what the significance is of this deal, how important it is, why there has been so much energy and time? What does it mean?
Well, I mean, from my point of view, I'm sure you understand that I'm not very many people share my viewpoint, but nevertheless, I'm quite certain about this, that there's a lot of both pro and con about this agreement that's simply based on misunderstanding. The reality is that the Iranians, were never interested in nuclear weapons, as I've said many times, and I know you've had me on to talk about that in the past. This was never really about the sort of forcing Iran to give up nuclear weapons ambitions or anything of the sort. And in fact, the Iranians really postured themselves putting up far greater numbers of centrifuges than they ever intended to use in order to push the Obama administration back to the negotiating table or to get the Obama administration to agree to negotiate seriously with Iran on this issue. Because from the Iranian point of view, and this goes back many years to the 1990s, they understood that the only way they were going to get the United States to reach an agreement with them that would, from their, they would hope at least would get rid of all the sanctions, including those that were not involved with, were not caused by the nuclear issue at all. The only way they could do it was to have something that would get the attention of the U.S. government. And they realized that the only way they could do that was to get the United States to believe that their nuclear program was a political problem that the U.S. had to solve by negotiating with Iran. And so that's really the background of this negotiation from the Iranian side. From the Obama administration side, if you look at the first 4 years of the Obama administration, from 2009 to 2012 or 2013, there was never any intention really to negotiate an agreement that would allow Iran to have any enrichment program at all. The idea was always that the U.S. would force Iran to give up its enrichment program, just like the Bush administration had demanded. But that's not the way it worked out. I mean, the Obama administration thought, well, now that we have crippling sanctions starting in early 2012, the Iranians will have to cave in. And I think they really believed that. But, of course, that's not the way it worked. The Iranians stood firm on demanding that they have an enrichment program. And in the end, because the Obama administration had committed itself to those negotiations, it had no choice but to follow it up and to go to the end. And I think that's the real story of the negotiations, not the story that is told by the opponents and not the story that's told by the Obama administration itself.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Gareth Porter. He writes for The Nation magazine. He's an investigative journalist and author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. His work also appears in the Middle East Eye. And I'd like to talk to you. I'm going to change the subject just a little bit here, whether it's Iran and the United States. But you've written a piece in which you raise an interesting question. And I'm a little confused by it, but the question is, why the U.S. and Iran aren't cooperating against IS or ISIS?
Right.
And it's interesting because I thought initially that behind the scenes and under the radar, Iran was cooperating with the U.S. against ISIS. Did that change?
Well, I think both sides are opposed to ISIS, but are they cooperating in any meaningful way? I think the answer is no. I mean, of course, they're on the same side in Iraq. That's true. And, I mean, you could say that they're cooperating in that sense, but they're not actually talking to one another. They're not sharing intelligence. They're not coordinating. They're not doing anything that would make their separate efforts more effective. Now, you know, I point out in my article that there are clear indications from the Iranian side that they would prefer, clearly, to have an explicit or tacit cooperation with the United States, clearly based on a recognition by both sides that they do, in fact, share the strategic interest in pushing back the Islamic State, or Daesh, as the Iranians call it. But the I mentioned in my article that at least two Iranian officials who I spoke with while I was in Vienna made statements to me indicating that that would be the preference of Iran, but they had found that there was resistance on the part of the United States, and they attributed that they guessed that there were people up high within the Obama administration, and they did not mention names, but they suggested that there were people who might believe that Daesh is useful to put pressure on the Assad regime in Syria. In other words, that that there's still a policy in the Obama administration that favors regime change, or at least that there's a debate, the differences of opinion within the Obama administration. Some people are really not very much in favor of regime change. Other people would favor regime change in Syria, and that's part of the problem that prevents any real cooperation between the two sides, between the U.S. and Iran, on the problem of the Islamic State. But in any case, the Iranians clearly have hinted, both publicly and privately, that they would favor that. But the Obama administration is not willing to do that, and I point out in my article that it's very clear the political problem here is not that there's a lack of understanding of geopolitics, which would cause certainly the United States to leap at the opportunity to cooperate with Iran against the Islamic State. It's domestic politics in the United States, both the problem of the Israeli lobby, and of course, your more attentive people listening to this will know that the Israelis they've not come out in favor of the Islamic State, but they certainly are cooperating with al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria, and they do not regard the Islamic State as the primary enemy. They regard Iran as the primary enemy. And, of course, the same thing is true of the Sunni Arab coalition against Iran, which is led by Saudi Arabia. So the problem is that the Obama administration is enmeshed in an alliance structure in the Middle East where all of its allies are against any cooperation with Iran against the Islamic State. And I think one has to see that as the fundamental logic that is guiding the policy of the Obama administration at this point.
So you're saying that sort of de jure, Israel is empowering ISIS.
It is definitely cooperating, not with ISIS, but with al-Qaeda. And I'm saying that they are clearly, they've argued this through their think tanks associated with Netanyahu and the present Israeli government, that ISIS is not the main threat. You cannot compare the threat of ISIS with the threat of Iran. It's Iran that is the real threat to the world and to the Middle East. So they're very explicit about that.
All right. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Gareth Porter. He writes for The Nation and regularly a wonderful source for information on this. It's called The Middle East Eye. It's called The Middle East Eye. Now, finally, and this is an incredibly interesting piece that you've written. It has to do with, well, a guy by the name of Mordecai Vanunu. Many people know who he is. A lot of people don't know, have the slightest idea who he is, although in Israel, he's sort of infamous and famous at the same time. Tell us about, remind us who Vanunu is, because he just did a very interesting interview, unusual, unprecedented, with the Times of Israel.
Right. First of all, Mordecai Vanunu is the Israeli whistleblower on the nuclear program of Israel, the nuclear weapons program of Israel. And this goes back, of course, decades, when he was, in fact, part of the program itself at Dimona. He was a scientist, an engineer, was part of the program, and was against Israeli nuclear weapons, and took photographs and knew the details of the program, and was beginning to talk to people outside the country. Took a trip to Europe. We were subject to a Mossad honey trap, using a woman to make it possible for them to capture him in Italy, as I recall. And he was in prison for many years. He has now been allowed to do an interview that has been cleared by military censors, and therefore is available. It was not with Times of Israel. It was a broadcast interview, and the Times of Interview did a story, obviously in the newspaper, on the interview. But it has been broadcast now in Israel, and that's a very interesting development. And I've been asking people that I know who are following Israel even more closely than I am what the significance of this is, and it's not clear at this point whether this represents any shift that has wider political importance or not. So I can't say at this point exactly what it means, but it's certainly a very interesting development that he can talk about a number of details about the nuclear program publicly at this point. And I just speculate that that this may be part of a broader, could be part of a broader Israeli policy decision to talk or to begin to allow talk about the existence of Israel's nuclear weapons as a response to the U.S.-Iran nuclear agreement.
Well, now, it is incredibly interesting because the fact that Israel has 100 or 200, we don't know how many because it is a nuclear renegade, it does
could
not...
Could be as many as 400.
Could be as many as 400 nuclear weapons. It's you know, every time you talk about nuclear weapons in Iran and you hear Israel saying, well, they're restraining themselves, you have to think about nuclear war. How could it be that there's so much attention on one country, this must make it impossible for real peace negotiations in the region where Israel, again, is a nuclear renegade. So this would signal a change because many people talk about a nuclear-free Middle East.
Well, it certainly signals some kind of change. But I think this is we just need to keep watching this closely because it means something, but it could be a variety. The variety of possibilities here. I hesitate to identify any particular one of them at this point as the most likely or certainly the one that we can count on. But definitely, I think people should watch for any sign of change in Israel's posture. I would say that it's important for people to keep a close eye on this whole question of the public posture that Israel takes on nuclear weapons, whether it's going to begin to open up the political space for discussion of the issue of its nuclear weapons arsenal. For whatever reason, whether it's for ill or for good, in other words, whether there's positive or negative connotation to it, I just don't know. But that's something to watch.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. I want to thank you very much, Gareth Porter, investigative journalist and author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Got a couple of important articles. The big one is in The Nation magazine.
That's right. Yeah,
that's
very long. I warn people in advance, it's extremely long.
Okay, well, that's good because a lot of information, a lot of work. We need to. This is one of the most important issues of our time, so we're glad you're on top of it. You also write for the Middle East Eye. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thanks so much, Dennis.
All right, bye-bye now.
listening to the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Finally, we feature another interview from Wednesday's program on an Israeli nuclear whistleblower interviewed for the first time on Israeli media. Listen to this.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, you've heard about the carnage in Yemen and the Saudi-led coalition and what's been going on there, which includes a great deal of civilian damage of infrastructure and killing of civilians. We've seen a bunch of reporting. What we haven't seen is the connection that the U.S. government has to this killing in Yemen. And joining us to talk about that is Jim Nurikis. He is with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and he's written a piece about this. Jim, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's good to have you with us. First of all, just remind people, how bad is the situation in Yemen now?
Well, as you say, that there are a lot of civilians being killed by the airstrikes. According to Doctors Without Borders, the death toll is in the hundreds of people, not counting combatants, just hundreds of civilians.
Hundreds of civilians killed, yes.
And this is, you know, overwhelmingly from the Saudi-led coalition, which has been dropping bombs, including cluster bombs, on the country in an effort to get rid of a government that they don't like.
Those cluster bombs are known as anti-personnel weapons because they shred folks. They shred flesh. They're an extremely devastating munition.
Yeah, they also tend to, you know, they have hundreds of smaller bombs in them.
Bomblets, yeah.
And they often tend to, many of them don't explode when the bombs are dropped, and so that they remain on the ground for civilians, often children, to come across them later to their peril.
And they're very interesting to children. They're shiny, and they're sort of foreign objects that a kid would be attracted to. Now, the Saudi, who is the Saudi-led coalition that's doing this bombing? Oh, it's the Saudis?
The United Arab Emirates are probably the second most prominent country in the alliance, but it's Saudi Arabia and a bunch of the sort of smaller satellite Arab states around Sunni states that are opposed to a Shia-led government in Yemen.
Okay, and just back to the bombs. Who, by the way, where are those bombs coming from? Where are those munitions coming from? Are they from the U.S.? How are the Saudis getting them?
They do come from the United States, and this is where FAIR is interested in this from a media point of view, is the United States is supplying the weaponry, much of the weaponry for this assault, and also providing what they call logistical and intelligence support for these attacks. And this is not a secret. The United States openly announced this at the commencement of the military campaign back in March. And it was covered at the time in U.S. newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times. We're talking about the U.S. having an open role behind the scenes in this war. But as the civilian death toll has mounted, the U.S. role has dropped out of the leading U.S. papers. So the papers that are the most in-depth papers aimed at the U.S. audience are leaving out the U.S. role in killing civilians in the Middle East. So I just think it's illustrative of the strange news values of our leading media that the U.S. role becomes less important, less interesting, less newsworthy as people are dying as a result of it.
Now, you said, Jim, and this is an important point, you said that the U.S. is supplying not only the anti-personnel weapons, these munitions, but they're supplying the intelligence, which means that's the intelligence that is killing the civilians.
Right. We're not privy to the war room of Saudi Arabia, but that is, when you're talking about intelligence in a war like this, you're talking about targeting decisions, you know, satellite information that is telling the bombers where they should bomb. And so, yeah, the United States plays
so if those kids are getting killed, the U.S. is deciding where the bombs are being dropped that are killing the civilians, including children.
Yeah. When you're talking about the cluster bombs, most countries in the world believe cluster bombs to be illegal. The United States is one of the few countries that has not signed the treaty that bans cluster bombs. And so the United States continues to make them and to sell them, including to Saudi Arabia. And the New York Times had a story about a report put out talking about cluster bombs and how they were still being used in a handful of conflicts, including in Yemen. And the story mentioned that, you know, it made clear how horrific these weapons are and mentioned that they had been banned by this treaty. And then the article said that the United States has not signed the treaty but abides by its provisions nevertheless, which is just not true. The treaty says not only can't you use cluster bombs, you can't make them, you can't store them, and you can't transfer them, including selling them. And so the United States certainly would, if the United States was a signatory to the treaty, it would be definitely in violation of it on several counts. And we pointed this out to the New York Times. We had our activist network alert them to this inaccuracy. And the Times, to its credit, did correct it that same day and rewrote the story to reflect the fact that the United States, in fact, is supplying cluster bombs, and some of the carnage that they're talking about is literally made in the USA.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Jim Nurekis from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. We're talking about the reporting around the killing of innocents in Yemen. It's a very bloody war. Hundreds of civilians are dying. The Saudis are being supplied by the U.S. via, as you say, via weaponry, ammunition. Also, the jets, right? They're coming. They came from the U.S. too. The jets they're flying.
Right. Yeah. The
so it's the jets, the munitions, the intelligence. The U.S. has to bear responsibility for the killing of these innocents. What are the human rights organizations saying about this?
They are very well aware of where these bombs are coming from. I have pointed out that the U.S. is responsible. But that is not, you know, there's a long tradition of the United States press being much more interested in covering human rights abuses when they come from official enemies than when they come from allies, and least interesting of all are human rights abuses that come from the United States itself.
And it's always of concern because it does, one gets the sense that the major papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times you single out tend to sort of play the role of the unofficial State Department when it comes to these kinds of foreign policy issues. Wouldn't you say that's a bit of a problem, that it's a bit of stenography journalism coming out of the State Department?
Yeah, you do get the sense that papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, which provide some of the most detailed coverage of overseas events for a U.S. audience, really see themselves as kind of unofficial representatives of the U.S. foreign policy apparatus. And this is kind of the lens that they present the news of the world to you through, that any sort of rough edges that make the United States' role in the world look less than humanitarian, less than idealistic, tend to get filed off and give you a very selective view of the world and world events.
So it's patriotism before good journalism at times.
Yeah, and you do almost get the sense that they're identifying less with the country than with the State Department as an institution. Very close relationships between these news outlets and both the diplomatic and intelligence apparatuses of the United States. These are the sources that you turn to if you're a reporter for the Times or the Post. Your job largely is defined as getting the information from the government and passing it on, particularly the information that they are, you know, that has been secret and they're trying to dole it out to the public. You won't be the reporter who gets that secret released first, unless you have a track record of playing ball with sort of PR branches of the state and the CIA.
So it's back to access or being punished with lack of access if you don't seem to follow orders. I want to get one more point. Maybe you have a little information. But it's my understanding that the U.S. corporations, the weapons manufacturers, are going to make a lot of money on this war in Yemen, supplying the various jets and munitions. Is there any sense of how that's looking now? Are they already cleaning up on this war?
Well, certainly we have a for-profit weapons industry in this country that is allied with the governmental agencies that are the war-making powers, and if you sell weapons overseas, it goes through the Pentagon. But they're being manufactured with the profit motive. And so these industries do have a definite incentive in seeing wars like these happen, that if U.S. allies are not involved in fighting wars, they're not using up the weaponry that's being sold. And the bottom line of companies that are making these things will definitely suffer. And that's when Eisenhower warned against the military industrial complex, this is what he's talking about, that you have this network where people who have an interest, a direct financial interest in war, get into a symbiotic relationship with the people who are making U.S. foreign policy. And I do think sometimes people talk about the military-industrial media complex, and I think they are bound up in that as well, that their sources are people who are profiting or will potentially profit from the wars that they're covering.
All right, I'm going to leave it right there. Jim Nurekis works with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. They try and keep an eye on the corporate media for all of us, been doing it for many years. Jim, thanks so much for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thanks for talking to us.
All right, bye-bye now.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll look more at consumerism. We'll hear the rest of the documentary, Consumed, and we'll hear some words on the subject by Charles Eisenstein, plus some overdue praise for the hippies. I hope you'll stay tuned. We're back to consumerism and overconsumption, and the social and economic systems that are requiring too much of both. We'll end the show with some reflections by Charles Eisenstein. And we'll start the show by hearing some more of a quirky but interesting documentary called Consumed. When we paused the film last week, Professor Alistair McIntosh and others were discussing that we live in a world of machines and appliances, and here's my own list, prepackaged salads and Doritos and air-conditioned buildings and internal combustion vehicles and designer toothbrushes and manufactured handbags and shoes and shirts with the all-important brand name of your choice. We live in a world of branded consumer goods, and we are hopelessly out of touch with the natural world. That out-of-touchness is good for capitalism. Pave paradise and put up a parking lot? That's simply good business. But it's bad for the planet, and it's bad for the human soul. We'll pick up the movie again as it gets into such matters. The point of view here is that consuming products and displaying these products to gain social status, psychologically, that's all perfectly natural. But we're carrying it way too far, to the point of self-destructiveness and social destructiveness and now global destructiveness. The movie's solution? Self-awareness. Well, what else would you expect a bunch of psychologists to say? In any case, if self-awareness won't be enough to solve the problem, it's probably at least a good place to start. So let's listen to the remainder of Consumed, Inside the Belly of the Beast.
I think that we become dissociated from the wild when we move out of relationship with hands-on experience of elemental reality, of fire, air, earth, and water. And when everything gets served up to us on a plate, because we've got a highly mechanized, computerized, globalized supply system in which we have lost touch with where things are coming from in the natural living world. And as a result of that losing touch, we're no longer able to care so much because we just don't feel it the same way.
The irony is, as human technology and history progress, we get increased mastery over the environment. With the agricultural revolution, instead of having to wander around for miles looking for hunted meat and berries and fruits and nuts, we focus just on our little patch of farmed land. We plow it. We get a reliable food supply. With the industrial revolution, you withdraw even further into your little bourgeois house. And what you care about are the mechanisms that surround you. Refrigerators, washing machines, you know, the telephones, all of that. Now your reach is greatly extended. You have more technical control over the environment with the Industrial Revolution. With the Marketing Revolution, you withdraw even further into yourself, and you just worry about the brands that surround you. You're not even worried about the technology anymore. You don't know how the plumbing works. You don't know how your car works. You just know what kind of car it is, what kind of refrigerator you've got. So there's a gradual withdrawal of focus from the environment at large into yourself and your own narrative.
It seems our ignorance of how nature works and what it does for us is exacting a terrible price. More people are chasing fewer resources. Food production is near the limits of growth. Oil has reached its peak. The world's population will pass 9 billion by 2050. Strong nations are reaching into weak nations to take what they need. Forests are cut down and the oceans emptied. Biodiversity is already collapsing. But as long as our economies continue to grow, we pretend not to notice. We're like the people on Easter Island, enthralled to our culture, throwing up structures that prove our mastery, ignoring the damage we are doing to the planet we share. We've always done it. Only now, we have reached the limits of what the planet can provide. Can the science of sustainability save us from this ongoing destructive tendency?
I would see sustainability as simply the ability for our species, human species, to survive long-term in its environment without damaging the carrying capacity of that environment, the capacity of the environment to support what is there.
I think that the issue of time is crucial to this. We've got this very short-term mindset, and part of sustainability has got to go as far as changing that psychological mindset towards a culture of permanence for not next few years, not next few decades, but for hundreds of years, thousands of years.
Okay, last year, the time. That one. I know, Alex. Do you know the time? Say yes or no. No. You don't. Yeah, I don't. Daddy, do you know the time?
It's no good to say, oh, we'll put a label on the product and say it's a bit greener than the other product and expect everyone to start buying the right thing. The problem goes deeper than that.
If you go to a waste recycling centre and you look at what's there, you will find that, particularly with electronic products, actually, which is e-waste, if you like, you'll find that what's there generally works. In a utilitarian sense, it still does what it was meant to do. Computers still compute, and fridges still make stuff cold. And I think what it throws into light is that there are different kinds of durability, and that other things have broken, like desire can break, fascination can break, mystery can break. Things can lose mystery and lose fiction very quickly. And all of these fantile properties that advertisers use very cleverly can break. They can die out. They can fade away. And so the challenge, the intervention, if you like, is about looking at ways of designing products and marketing products and consuming products that have a sustainable kind of meaning and a very durable set of values and desires, so that we perhaps don't fall out of love with them so quickly. Like the way a pair of denim jeans, for example, picks up patina and age through use, or may contain rips or stains which only the owner really knows what they're about. And that links back then, of course, to narrative.
We're only going to actually address sustainable consumption properly as a society, as communities. Individuals can do so much, but ultimately we'll just lose hope, and we'll find it just too much like hard work for us to bear that burden of having to do the right thing when we go shopping all the time. We need to complement the small step changes that individuals do with a bigger vision that ultimately can only be introduced by far-sighted industry people. It needs industry to think about new business models as well, so that their profits in future don't depend on selling cheap throwaway rubbish, but in fact their profitability is built into providing products that last, and maybe their profits are partly dependent on them providing us a good service to keep those goods in service for longer.
Large producers are saying, we would now like to consider making products that people want to keep for longer. We know how to make a washing machine that works for 30 years. We know how to do that. But what we don't know how to do is to design a washing machine that somebody wants to keep for 30 years, because we haven't trained consumers to consume that way. And there is a shift, and there are changes happening, and design, sustainable design, if you like, is at one of the edges of that shift.
I think that the politics of sustainability is only one part of it. There's the old feminist maxim that the personal is the political is the personal, and you need both sides of that. You need to look at what a human being is, what our inner lives are about, in order to understand what the potentialities for political change can be.
The two major presidential candidates vote like all the other citizens. One of them in New York City describes himself as a lawyer. The other, up in the country where his home is, gives his occupation as farmer.
Drawn to power and prestige, politicians display all the traits that have got us into this mess in the first place. The very competitiveness of their nature marries perfectly with modern society, and they are unlikely to find the answers we need.
Sadly, when you think of security, you think of, like, how many resources do we have in the world? And certainly there's plenty to provide for all. And it seems odd that we have so much striving and insecurity, given that's true. But social status is sort of a zero-sum game. No matter if you live on the richest island or the poorest island in the world, your social group will always have a low-ranking person and a high-ranking person and everyone in between. So there's always a context for that striving to be higher status, because it's a relative condition to the whole group. And we are, I think, shaped by evolution to desire to be higher status.
Our brains are programmed for survival, prestige, and above all, growth. And we have created a society that reflects and facilitates this. Humanity and its grip on the environment will continue to grow until everything the planet has to offer is consumed. It is just how evolution works.
You know, I was giving a talk in America, and afterwards somebody came up to me and he said, "Let me tell you a story." He said, "I used to be a hippie back in the days when hippies were real hippies. And two of my hippie friends wanted to go to Cuba to meet the great Che Guevara. So they got there and they managed to get an audience. And the first thing they did as they shook hands with him was they apologized for being Americans. And the great Che said to them, 'Don't you apologize for being Americans. You see, you're the lucky ones. You get to live in the belly of the beast.'" His point being that stuck out in the Caribbean and Cuba, there wasn't a lot he could do to impact upon what was going on in the mainstream of the world. Whereas when you're actually in the belly of the beast, you're on the cutting edge of the potential for change. And I would say that that's how, as a human species, we are just now. Right now, we are living in that uncomfortable belly of the beast. We are living in the jaws of the tiger. But that is a powerful place for becoming aware and for deepening what it means to be human, to carry the future forward.
Is this a symbol of our children's future? A future of struggle as our world unravels at the seams? Is this how things will get changed? The philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer said we are all just animals getting along with our lives. Can we grow to be something other than this?
One of the problems is that the current economic system is based on volume and production. Very simple principle that the more you produce and sell, the more money you make. And it's a constant acceleration of production. And part of that is market share and keeping up with competition and kind of outdoing and beating competitors, which is survival. It's Darwin. It's normal. But part of it is also a blindness to other possibilities. Eric Fromm talks about the distinction between having and being. Whereas having is more of a positing those internal values and aspirations and existences within things around you. And it's a more, I would say it's a more remote process is having, but it's also a very unstable and stressful process because you're essentially investing yourself in everything other than yourself. Your existence is basically vomited out of you onto this table full of things, objects, that are trying to sort of help you exist, but actually don't do that at all.
I actually think runaway consumerism is a temporary historical glitch, a kind of exception to the human norm. For a couple million years, we did perfectly well socializing and attracting mates and raising kids through this informal face-to-face interaction, through ordinary language. And then we invented all of this stuff, all of this technology, the economy, the free market. And we realized, oh, maybe it helps us get a little bit of an advantage. I think that's actually a superficial response to technology, and I think we'll grow out of it. I think once people understand their own psychology better, we won't care as much about consumption. And I think the result will be we won't waste as much matter and energy, and we'll treat the planet a lot better.
We must acknowledge that we have become captives in a consumerist system. We cannot see the bars or understand what keeps us in. But even if we have doubts, we are swept along by the stampede around us. Things do need to change. We are wrecking the planet. But we must understand that revolution doesn't come from within a system. Revolutions are born of you and me. They may be as simple as a change of heart. They may be as difficult as saying, I've had enough.
Have we all got to become hippies? Or, you know,
aren't we already all hippies? I mean, it's interesting, the whole hippie thing. I mean, leaving aside the sort of dirty hippie stereotype, you know, the kind of person who's sort of lazy, just couldn't care less. Leaving aside that, because I don't think that's what the real hippie thing is about. The real hippie thing is about being able to dance, being able to move from your hips, if you like. And I mean that metaphorically. I mean that in life. I mean that in the sense of going with the flow of life, being able to turn on to what's around you, to tune in to the deep undercurrents, and to drop out of what yields death, and to drop in to what gives life. And we get our politics wrong when we don't take account of that, because we think it's only about outward competitiveness and consumption that matters. We don't realize that there's much more to us, something much more beautiful to us.
And thus ends Consumed, with Professor Alastair MacIntosh's excellent assessment of the great value of the hippie culture of the late 60s, early 1970s. I will add that genuine hippies were fairly few, but their styles and values permeated popular culture and scared the beatitudes out of the established power. Hippie-inspired culture was democratic, anti-authoritarian, inclusive, communal, anti-war, creative, and also intelligent, much more aware of history than our parents, and much less materialistic than the norm. Hippies rejected capitalist striving and rejected the consumer lifestyle. They rejected the idea of seeking fulfillment through purchasing consumer goods, with the possible exception of record albums and marijuana. In our oil short, capital short, globally warming future, we're going to have to be more like hippies and less like yuppies. And if that's bad for corporate profits, so be it. Economist and philosopher Charles Eisenstein has some related thoughts. As he sees it, the declining world economy will necessitate lifestyles less caught up in making, selling, and buying consumer goods. This is from a video. I could cut out the picture, but the background music had to stay. Okay, you've been warned. Here is Charles Eisenstein.
I guess 2012 is the year, maybe we'll look back on it and we'll say, yeah, that's the year that the growth paradigm really ended. I mean, obviously there's still growth in, you know, China, Turkey, India, the BRIC countries, there's still economic growth, but it slowed down this year. And in Europe, it stalled. And the United States, there was a little bit of growth, you know. And I think that people in the system are starting to understand that the good old days are not coming back. And they haven't really processed this in any meaningful way because their economic models don't work. Their financial policies don't work. I mean, everything is predicated on growth. And we don't really have the tools to manage an economy that isn't growing. So when we're talking about the end of growth, what does that really mean? And for an economist, the end of growth means that fewer goods and services are being exchanged for money. In our current economic paradigm, that's called a recession. And it means unemployment. And it means falling wages. And it means hardship. But it doesn't have to mean that. Already people are beginning to voluntarily reclaim parts of life for money, reclaim their time from work, and therefore, you know, they can consume less of the things that they buy with money and work less for money. But does that really impoverish life? Not necessarily. People are beginning to value leisure more. They're beginning to value growing their own food. They're beginning to value taking care of each other without being paid to do it. You know, does it really hurt your quality of life for you and every neighbor on your block to share half the number of cars that you own now? Would it really hurt your quality of life to have only one exercise machine for every 10 households? So I think really what we need to let go of is the idea that growth is necessary for prosperity and for wealth, for a good life. The elites are trapped in their ways of thinking. In private, the opinion leaders among the elite, they're having the conversations. Publicly, they won't broach some of these more radical proposals. It's not even radicalism, it's just common sense, you know? And if you're not weighed down with ideology and the apparatus of power and the institutions and institutional behavior, if you're not weighed down with those things, it's not hard to see what we should do. In Europe, I was in some places that haven't really been hit by austerity yet, and I was also in Portugal, I was in Ireland, where they're really directly feeling that, you know, the old days are gone. People are looking back at that time with a bit of chagrin. You know, they're not really blaming the global system. They're saying, yeah, we were living to excess, and now we're coming back down to earth like it was in the 80s, and the party's over. Yeah, I don't think it's going to take that much for the people on the street, the common people, to consider policies and agendas that are off the radar screen, that the elites would not consider. A lot of people, I mean, I've even been there, you know, where part of you is afraid of this collapse, and part of you kind of wants it to happen. And sometimes people even get addicted to these collapse websites, you know, where every day you go there, you're looking for the latest bit of bad news, the latest crisis that's brewing, you know, and just kind of hoping that today the stock market's going to have dropped by 50%. There's this kind of glee, almost, even though another part of you knows very well that it would be catastrophic, perhaps. Like, what's it going to be like when your ATM card doesn't work and there's no food in the supermarket? But there's part of us that wants that to happen because the world that we live in is not good enough. We have an understanding, a knowledge that the world is supposed to be much more beautiful than what's been offered to us as normal. Like, just the feeling like we can do better than this. I find that all the time when I'm driving in suburbia in the United States, and you get a bit of it in Canada too, you know, and just like these ugly big box stores, you know, and you're like, after 3,000 years of architectural development. Is this the best we can do? You know, you see people working in these really tedious jobs, inputting data, you know, or scrubbing toilets, you know, and spending their whole lives doing menial labor. And you think, wasn't technology supposed to have liberated us from this? You know, when do we get to enjoy the fruits of thousands of years of culture and technology? Like, we can do better than this. And so it's quite natural that we want things to fall apart. It's that we want to get out of here and we don't know how. And people feel trapped in their jobs, trapped in their lives, trapped in just the society around us that kind of compels certain behaviors and certain kinds of relationships. You know, we want to live in a world where it's normal to make eye contact with people. We want to live in a world where people love their work and look forward to Monday, or maybe don't even distinguish between leisure and work. You know, like, why can't we have that? And we don't know how to get there, but we know it's supposed to be much more joyous and authentic and beautiful than what we experience as normal. And we feel trapped, and so we want it to fall apart, because then something new can be born.
And on that note, I bid you a fond adieu, and thank you for listening to New World Notes. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, and as we used to say back when, tune in, turn on, drop out. Be here now. And remember, war is not healthy for children and other living things. Peace.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today originally aired in January of 2014, and here it is. Today, Adnan Zubairi joins me on the show. He's the producer of the movie 9/11 in the Academic Community, which won a University of Toronto Film Festival Award and which tackles the issue of why 9/11 discourse is taboo at universities in both Canada and the United States. Adnan Zubairi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Cheryl.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and then what got you interested in the 9/11 truth movement?
Sure. When I was an undergraduate student at the University of Waterloo, I was running a group called the University of Waterloo 9/11 Research Group. And the purpose of the group was to basically have gatherings with the general public, with students and professors of the university, to basically discuss much of the research that has been going on surrounding the events of September 11, 2001. And so it was an educational group, and we were trying to learn more about 9/11 and how it's impacted the world ever since. I learned some interesting things during my time as a student. I went around with other graduate students door-to-door, meeting with professors from different departments, talking to them about what I call critical perspectives on 9/11. That may not be terminology that other people within the movement pushing for an investigation for what happened on that fateful day may call it, but that's at least the words that I use. And I generally found that professors, there was definitely something in the atmosphere that was blocking the discussion in talking about critical perspectives on 9/11. And there was definitely a taboo there, which one is not able to discuss things like scientific evidence and things like that. And so I began to realize that no matter how good the evidence is, and even if it's published in the best journals, if there's a taboo there, the issue will not get any type of mainstream discussion. And so I began documenting the taboo itself. And ironically, I think this is kind of interesting, that it started getting interest from mainstream academics at the highest levels. I thought that was something very interesting. By talking with the taboo itself about the evidence, it has received much attention, has made its way into curriculum, and it continues to make its way into curriculum, I should say. So that's just an introduction.
And so from that research that you did, you were motivated to then do the film.
That's right. When I got to meet with people, I began to realize there's definitely a very peculiar phenomena. Professors, when we're students, they're very, well, at least we see them as godly personalities. They're supposed to guide us in research and in the classroom and how to think or how to do critical thinking. But suddenly when it came to this, I must say, unfortunately, I observed some very unusual behavior on their part. I would go in their offices and I would show them a couple of papers that have been published about critical perspectives on 9/11, and I would go through like a 30 seconds of silence period, become a frozen vegetable. I wouldn't know what to say, and they're kind of frozen as well. And from being people that are gods of lecturing in the classroom that can go on, they suddenly became silent. So I was like, wow. But the media brings on people like these who we believe to be that objective or unbiased, but they're actually enormous institutional pressures that may warp their thinking or silence them in certain ways that are quite subtle. They're not well documented, the pressures that are in the background. And so I thought it was important to document that.
What do you see as some of those pressures? Even though they're subtle, is there a way you can identify some of them for us?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because when it came to the types of pressures, let me just discuss how the taboo is handled and how the pressures come through an interaction of institutions. So I began recognizing that taboo exists mainly through two reasons. If people generally feel that something is an issue, then they try to voice their concerns about it. So if you go in academia and you try to say something like verbally in a speech, let's say, where generally you make yourself quite public by saying that, you know, I read the official story, the official commission report, I read it in detail, and found out that at the crux of it, what they tell us about 9/11, it's based on torture testimony, and then the person they tortured to get this entire story about what happened on 9/11, that person said that he just made it up because he's just trying to free himself from the torture. And then the tapes that had the so-called recorded torture testimony, the Central Intelligence Agency then destroyed many of those tapes. So you begin to realize, wow, what are these are some major violations of scholarship. This is 10 times worse than plagiarism. So, and that's the approach I take, but even if one says things like that in a very public way, a storm comes on you in academia. So if you verbally discuss something, basically you have so many academics that come chasing after you. I documented one case of this. It was John McMurtry, who was perhaps the foremost ethical philosopher in Canada. He's a very distinguished academic here. And there were his own friends at Harvard wrote a letter to him. I still can't believe this to this day. They notified him that they're reporting him to the FBI and the CIA for basically raising some very good questions. And so if you speak out about it, then there will be major pressures from academics. Then if you try the second approach, which is, okay, let me sit down and do the so-called scholarly practice, which is to gather my research, do my fact-checking, and submit it in a paper to a journal. So this is the second phenomenon I documented. Basically, there's lots of papers. There's over 20 papers now in peer-reviewed journals in different fields, from economics and engineering and the humanities and social sciences. And there's 20 papers there, and there's zero discussion. There's just no circulation.
And these 20 papers challenge the official story of 9/11.
Yeah, they come under what I call critical perspectives on 9/11. And so they will be questioning things like, how can you base this entire story on torture?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when the person says he just made it up. Or engineering issues with the buildings and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that what we observed and how rapidly the buildings came down, when you actually do an analysis in structural dynamics, it shows that buildings don't come down that way, and that was published by professors that I know in structural engineering. And so these are really important things. I think one paper that really stands out in the highest journals is a paper by Alan Potashman. He's a professor of mathematical finance at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he was given confidential data by the Securities and Exchange Commission because they themselves may have been curious about whether there was unusual market activity going on in the days leading up to 9/11, meaning someone may have possibly had some idea that these airliners would be going into the buildings, and so someone made a lot of money off of it by purchasing put options, which are in a way bets about which way the markets will go pertaining to those options, and you can make a lot of money if you're right about those predictions. And it was unprecedented in terms of that type of market activity, and so they gave him confidential data, and Professor Potashman did what an academic does. He got right to the chase, and he did his analysis, and it's a probabilistic analysis, and he concluded that something to the order of 99% there was insider trading on those airlines. And now it was published in the Journal of Business, which is a publication of a very high impact factor. I mean, it's really well-regarded. It's a business school publication.
Mm-hmm.
It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Anyone who knows anything about universities knows that University of Chicago has so many Nobel Prize winners associated with it. It's a very major university. And to have a paper published on their name like that, and it got zero attention. And this is the point that Professor Zaremka makes, is like, it's extraordinary. You can write a paper about, you know, if you have the death penalty, does it increase or decrease the probability of crime? You're going to have hundreds of academics that will be publishing papers in support of you or against you. There'll be a lot of debate. And now here we have something even of much greater importance in this zero discussion. And so if you speak out about it, you get punished. If you do the scholarly practice of publishing papers, then there's zero discussion. If this was the case with, like, let's say, a medical science activity, let's say there's something, you're doing some research on cancer, you speak out about it, you get in trouble. If you publish about it, no one talks to you. You definitely realize that there's something wrong here.
Right, because this is a defining event of our times, and for people to ignore it, it is pretty amazing.
So there's a taboo there. So when it comes to institutional pressures, I mean, it has to do with more of the first case. When a university or professors within the university start speaking out about it, this is what happened to Professor William Woodward at the University of New Hampshire. And basically what happened was that many students rallied to get him fired when he expressed his opinion that the Bush administration may have allowed the 9/11 attacks to go forward. And basically what happened was that there are pressures that cascade down. They basically come through an interaction of institutions. And the other institution I'm referring to is, of course, those of political parties and government. And basically, it comes down to threatening the funding of universities, especially if they're like state-funded universities. And so they said that in their next legislative meetings that they'll actually discuss the university's budget if that professor is not fired by that time. And so the university was able to quietly cut a deal, maintain his professorship. And those are tough times. And so there are, behind the university, there's also the government. And if a university does ever stick out its neck, too many of its professors come out on this issue, then there will be some really serious repercussions. So a lot of my time goes into not just documenting these things, but in actually working out a larger framework with professors on how to proceed strategically with allowing critical perspectives on a variety of issues concerning the origins of war, how to go forward with them, and how to make pathways into curriculum.
That sounds great. Now, I know some of these same professors were free to criticize the Bush administration for the lies they told to take us into the war in Iraq, and they were against our civil liberties being taken away by the Patriot Act, but that they won't go near 9/11. And that always seems quite interesting to me, because we know that Bush lied to us about going into the war in Iraq, and even one of the lies was to connect it to 9/11, Saddam Hussein to 9/11. So why do you suppose they feel safe doing that but not going as far as 9/11?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's paradoxical, isn't it, Cheryl?
Yes.
I mean, you have academics who are very critical of government administrations about how they take us to war. There are academics who believe that many wars are based on lies, they're based on flimsy evidence, they're war crimes. But 9/11 is an exception. 9/11 does not deserve any type of critical inquiry and so forth. I know there is a professor, a distinguished professor of political science at Yale University, who I'm in touch with at the moment. His name is Charles Lindblom. And he was also examining many forms of literature. And this is an exceptional individual, by the way, in that he was looking at so much literature and how people discuss things, how academics discuss things. And he was looking at a broader form of it. A lot of people say that the reason why these things happen is because people are indoctrinated to emphasize certain things and de-emphasize other things. But he was looking at more subtle forms of indoctrination, which is like self-induced. He calls these impairments, that there's a broader type of issue and inquiry called impairment, and that people are, he quoted someone called Leo Szilard, who was a nuclear scientist. Upon visiting the U.S., he said that, it was quite a famous line that exemplifies this phenomenon of impairment. He said, Americans are free to say what they think, but they do not think what they are not free to say. So it was a very powerful line, and it's not just applicable to Americans, but intellectuals around the world, where they're free to say what they think. They'll even say some very controversial things, but the very things that they are not free to say, and which their entire credibility may vanish in a second, they just don't think those things. And yet, those are the very issues that are the, you know, the originating sources of many of today's most major problems, like the war on terror. And more to that, I think a lot of people spend time on Chomsky, saying he is the main example of a person who has these type of impairments. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
One can read his book. It was his best seller, called 9/11. That's the name of his book. And in his book, the documentary also points this out. Chomsky says that even though the evidence against the perpetrators of 9/11 was really thin, and even though the anthrax was found to be coming from a U.S. bioweapons laboratory, let's presume that the official story is still correct. And, you know, and people even reading his books, the followers of Chomsky and academics on the left, I'm not even sure if they blink when they read that. They're like, what? What did he just say? Despite all these things, let's just presume it to be correct. And so there are these forms of impairments that are there in professional, in academic inquiry. And so we're making, in discussing things along these lines, I found that sociologists are, when I speak to them through email about using the word impairment and discussing it in more detail, they seem to be catching on. They seem to be catching on. So even though I'm everything I'm saying has a very negative aspect to it, but there's a lot of positive progress being made in discussing these.
Now, do you think it's safer for Canadian professors to discuss this in the academic setting than American professors? Because I noticed, like, even with the Toronto hearings, it was a lot of Canadian professors that were driving that effort. So I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that it might be easier by 1%.
Okay.
I'm aware of the issues surrounding certain Canadian academics as well, and we're almost no different than American universities, at least from what I've seen.
Oh, interesting.
It's really weird, isn't it? But even though I'm aware of here up north, we're very similar to American universities in many ways, in how we socialize, the pressures that act on us.
Right, the same media manipulation and all of that.
Yeah, and we saw what happened to Professor John McMurtry. Wow, I mean, he got it very rough.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of academics asking for him to be fired.
Was he able to keep his position?
He was, but that's also because he was a part of the Royal Society of Canada. He was promoted to the title of Distinguished Professor of the university, which only four or five people have out of all the thousands of academics there. So they eventually decided, okay, let's let him keep his job under some pretense of academic freedom. And I think the university still did a good job, but they could have done more. But if it wasn't for those distinctions that he had.
Yeah, I think he's amazing. I've heard him. I've played some of his speeches on the radio show. He's just got such a way with language.
Never had those type of honors. I think there could have been a possibility where he may have been removed.
Mm-hmm.
I know another professor in Canada who just wrote an article, which was a very, very well-written article about critical perspectives on 9/11. And it wasn't about any type of wild conspiracy theories, but it was just discussing problems inherent in the commission report. And he was right during an interview with another university. The first question they asked in the job interview was, do you think 9/11 was an inside job? And so when we talk about our Canadian universities, do they have it any easier than American? I would say no.
Why do you think academics should be interested in 9/11 at all anyway? What's their role? Why would they need to be interested in this, or should they? What's their role in society?
I think that there are many answers one can give to this as to why, because there's so many different departments in academia, different disciplines. We can discuss why engineers should be interested, why political scientists should be interested. So let me try to just focus on one group of academics, let's say social scientists.
Okay.
That will kind of get the idea across. So the example I was giving was, when it comes to institutions of education, you may remember growing up, Cheryl, that plagiarism was a very, very bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you plagiarize, that's the end of your scholarly reputation and so on and so forth. And that's still the way many educational institutions are, and in a way it's good that they emphasize that. But here we have something that's 10 times bigger than just plagiarism. We have here a piece of work, the 9/11 Commission Report, which is almost 600 pages, and it was at its very crux of how the entire operation of 9/11 happened, how these men were, alleged 19 hijackers were chosen by bin Laden in the cave in Afghanistan and all these things. Basically, this whole thing came from torture testimony. And when you have the person, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, I was looking at the back of the 9/11 Commission Report. I was going through its citations. It's absolutely extraordinary. It just says KSM, meaning Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They got this info from him. And pages just go on and on. KSM, KSM, KSM. So, if you're cited that many times, you must be the most famous scholar in the world, okay? But this guy was basically cited throughout the commission report. It was through almost 183 waterboardings in 1 month. He was told that one of his family members might be killed or a whole number of things, and he told the ICRC, the Red Cross, that he just made stuff up. And so here's a story. It's proposed to us as a form of scholarship. It's put in a book with a really small print. This is the point that Graham McQueen makes. And it's based on something that makes plagiarism look extremely small. Professors, why should they be interested? The answer to the question is, this is an abuse. This is anti-scholarship. It doesn't have just to do with 9/11. If anyone does this with any type of major world event and starts changing domestic and foreign policies, for the worse, not for the better, or scaling back civil liberties and things like that, based on an assault on a scholarship. Every academic since the foundation of the scholarship is how they've based their entire lives around, built their lives around. They need to be involved that way, and which is exactly how I'm able to get people who specialize in the philosophy of ethics, the ethics of torture, and so forth, to get them to view the film from that light. And so it is, at the same time, I should say that there's a lot of good news that there is interest from these type of angles. It's just most of them don't know about it. So when it comes to the general public, I would say that it's extremely important that they are connected to their educational institutions on this topic. There are three institutions that have failed us. The media has failed us. Political parties have failed us. And the universities have overall also failed us on this subject. But we are making more progress with universities, the institution of universities, than we are with the other two institutions. This is the best progress we're making so far, in my own opinion. And so I feel that it's important that we talk to students and professors and that we have their support on this. Credibility is really important. They're not people who have formal power, like access to changing policy and stuff like that. but they have a lot of, as Graham McQueen has said, they have like informal power through high status in society, credibility, and influence. And if they were all to get together, a great majority of academics, they could actually stop this whole war machine.
Ah, you really think so? That's interesting.
Yeah, and just to give a very quick example, back in the late 1930s, the preeminent professor of philosophy, Martin Heidegger, he's known for providing the foundations for existentialism, which is a branch in philosophy and metaphysics. And right after becoming president of the University of Heidelberg in Germany, in just 2 weeks of becoming president, at the very time the German people were having doubts about the sophistication and intellect of the Nazis, Professor Heidegger, he announced his support for the Nazi Party. And basically it sent a wave of intellectual legitimization across Germany in intellectual circles, and it just gave the Nazis a free pass to walk right into the universities. Academics are a very small portion of our society, but they play enormous roles. We don't notice this, but they play enormous roles. Even if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, what government official in their right mind is going to write up a 600-page report? They don't. They get academics to do it. They got Philip Zelikow, who is a, right now a distinguished professor of history and associate dean of the graduate studies at the University of Virginia, to write the report. They get academics to do these. And so I think they are a very small sector of society, but we need to specialize in understanding how to communicate with them and how to get them into the right direction.
Now, you have a website for the movie. Could you tell the audience what that is and what they might find there?
Sure. The website is 911inacademia.com, and from there they can learn more about the documentary. I must say that I'm sorry at the moment if I've halted the sales of the film, as I'm trying to use the profits to send out films to professors. It's not so much of a public approach, where most activism relies on the conventional approach of getting the word out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually doing the exact opposite, which is it's a large-scale private approach. And perhaps that's the very reason why we're having some unprecedented success that way, where just about any professor I speak to, they do respond back with a very positive word, and it makes its way into the classroom. I've seen it just happen so many times that I would welcome people to help out, if they're interested, in a large-scale private approach.
And what kind of a response have you had so far to the film, other than what you've just shared with us?
I guess there's many ways we can discuss this, like endorsements, where people write recommendations for the film. These are people who are new to this line of inquiry. They have not had the time to look into this in the past. And they're not just any professors, they're very high-ranking professors. One example would be Roger W. Bowen. This man served as the president of the State University of New York at one of their major campuses, and he saw the film, and he wrote an endorsement for it. That's pretty high up in the academy. I sent it to a person who just finished his term as president of the American Association of University Professors. This person has also held defense fellowships, and sent it to him, and he wrote an email that he wrote a confession in the email saying that for some reason, perhaps due to my own lack of thinking or due to the U.S.-centric media, I was not able to think of these type of things. And that's exactly what we were talking about earlier, Cheryl, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Impairments that people do not think what they are not free to say. And so there are these forms of external indoctrinations and self-induced indoctrinations that accumulate into this broader form of impairment and inquiry. And now there are people who have served as pretty high up in the directorate of the White House Terrorism Task Force, others in the Senate Intelligence Committee, and at least in Canada, people who have served as presidents of the Royal Society of Canada, and so forth. I've received responses from many people in these categories, and they've been very, very positive, and it's made its way into curriculum at many universities in Canada in engineering classes.
Oh, fantastic.
In the sociology of terrorism classes at the University of Western Ontario. That's a direct example there. It's received perfect feedback. You know, whenever we write an essay, there's some grumpy teacher who always just takes a couple marks off, doesn't want to give 100.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, I'm surprised that it's received perfect feedback, and there's a distinguished professor of law at the University of Iowa who will be showing it to his law school class. And so it's definitely getting out there. I just have trouble keeping up with it.
Now, we're almost out of time, Adnan. Is there anything that you'd like the listeners to know that we haven't already talked about?
I would encourage people to think in a different way about how to make progress on this most difficult topic. That many of us rely on a public approach, trying to get stuff into the newspapers. And if you write something in newspapers, the very next day the media just reverts back to the language of the dominant official narrative. And so when these institutions fail and our approaches fail, public approaches, trying to get the word out, I would encourage a different way of thinking about how private social relations can be worked up the ladder to try to change things. And I would encourage people to contact me as to how that is being done and how we can work with that.
Okay, and they can contact you through the website.
Absolutely.
911inacademia.com.
Yes. It was a real pleasure to be on your show, Cheryl.
Yes, it was a real pleasure having you on the show, Adnan. And thanks for all your work in creating the movie 9/11 in the Academic Community. And again, the show you just heard originally aired in January of 2014. You can get a copy of the film 9/11 in Academia at the website 911inacademia.com. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now, there is a commemorative marker at the site where a flood wall protecting the lower ninth wall collapsed, unleashing a wall of water 10 years ago during Hurricane Katrina. The resulting flood wiped out the African-American neighborhood and killed scores of its residents. And now what has been left in its wake is little more than the commemorative marker at the site where the flood wall protecting the neighborhood collapsed.
10 years after Hurricane Katrina made landfall in southeast Louisiana, journalist, author of Katrina After the Flood, Gary Rivlin, retraces the storm's damage, the city of New Orleans' efforts to rebuild itself, and the storm's lasting effects, not just on the city's geography and infrastructure, but on the psychic, racial, and social fabric of that city, highlighting the mass dislocation of the African-American residents of the Lower Ninth Ward and why the neighborhood still hasn't been thrown a life preserver.
And we'll continue to ask whether government's benign neglect of the impoverished African-American population has still not been answered for, and indeed whether it continues to sacrifice the poor on the altar of whiter and wealthier developers and development. Gary Rivlin, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, I want to begin with actually a post by the Color of Change, which says, hey, 10 years ago, it was the Gulf Coast. Now it's Oakland and Sanford. It's Ferguson and Staten Island. It's Baltimore, Chicago, and Waller County, Texas. And it's still New Orleans. The fight to improve the lives of black folks is happening everywhere. What they are saying is that what happened during Katrina was a systemic failure of government from the White House down to the mayor's office. Can we start with that? Is that your assessment, that that is a primary lesson to take away as we watch the gleeful presence of George W. Bush at one of the charter schools on the 10th anniversary of Katrina?
Right. It's yes, it was a systematic failure, and maybe it's worse. Is we all, the whole world, saw the failures of the Bush administration to rescue folks who were stuck for 5 days. 25,000 people were stuck for 5 days at the Superdome. Another 20,000 at the convention center. They weren't rescued to day six or seven. This is a city right along a river. I mean, it shouldn't have been that hard if it had been more of a priority. But, you know, what's worse to me is in the rebuilding, the way race and class played this insidious role that helped shape a New Orleans that's very different today than it was at the time of Katrina.
I wonder if you could expand on that, not only in terms of it being a failure, but perhaps what has happened has been a proactive policy on the part of the ruling class to change the composition of the city.
So let's start with public housing. We'll start with, you know, low-income African-Americans. Some public housing was flooded, but much of it wasn't. But rather than opening it in those first months when the city was desperate for affordable housing, right? I mean, 80% of the city was covered with water, so housing was at a real premium. They never opened. Even those units that were not flooded, they're just all surrounded in fencing and razor wire on top and never opened. Year one, year two, people are desperate. People's stuff was inside, but they never let them inside. And, in fact, the big four housing project units in New Orleans, all of them were knocked down. All of them were replaced by mixed income. New Orleans, the city with the oldest public hospital, Cherry Hospital, in the country, it and Bellevue date back to 1736 by coincidence. Moderate damage. FEMA said $100 million we could fix it up. The doctors, the nurses, the other staff there started working on it. But the state before Katrina had wanted to shut it down. And, you know, Naomi Klein, disaster capitalism, this was the moment. Shock doctrine, this was the moment that they could take advantage. New Orleans now has no public hospital. You know, Charity Hospital is just sitting there moldering. It has never opened. It will never open. You just go down the line. Renters, 54% of New Orleans for renters. There was a lot of concern for homeowners in New Orleans, but there was never a plan to help renters back to have affordable housing for people. Because what happens when most of your city is flooded? Rents soared. It went up like the first year, like 30-35% rents, and so it became this unaffordable place, especially for the working poor, those who work in the kitchen help, the housekeepers in the big hotels, trying to get by on $15,000-$20,000 a year, and suddenly rents are going up by 35%.
You know, Gary, the reason one of the other reasons I mentioned Bush is the systems of government patted themselves somewhat on the back as they look at the bright, shiny new streets and pavement in the heart of New Orleans, which, of course, many of the long-term residents, African-American, have described as kind of Disneyfied or poor caricature of the culture that exists theretofore. But we have Mr. Bush in a charter school, and virtually all of the schooling, if not all of it, is now charterized. And one of the things that hit me is that most of the jobs previously in the school system were African-American individuals who were certainly aspiring towards the middle class. Those jobs were completely wiped out, and now you have a privatized, deunionized workforce that is without benefits, without the other protections that unions had. And so it's a further destruction of the job base and quality of life in the true sense of the African-American workforce. Is that something that, I mean, it was something that just kind of hit me. Is that something that you've seen as a reality of the loss of public sector jobs and so on?
Yeah, so we were talking about the working poor, lower income folks. Now let's step up the class ladder. So teachers, administrators, more middle class jobs. So the state, the moderate Democrat at the time, Kathleen Blanco, had been pushing prior to Katrina to take over some of the New Orleans public schools. Some of them were not doing well. I mean, understood what the motivation was there. But, you know, there's a duly elected school board. And so before the storm, there was an effort, and they took over three or four of the worst performing schools. But after the storm, within two months of Katrina, the state had taken over virtually every public school in New Orleans. St. Bernard Parish, it's a suburban parish just south and east of New Orleans. It was 100% flooded. They didn't lay off all their teachers. They put them on, emergency leave. They didn't have the money to pay them, full time. But as soon as they started rebuilding the schools, they were the first ones hired back. Orleans Parish, the New Orleans public school, they fired en masse every single teacher, every single employee, 7,000 or so people. And that's, by the way, on top of the 3,000 city workers who were laid off at around that time. So you had like 10,000 families, largely African-American, dealing with a loss of job at the same time they're losing homes and they're displaced. And there was a lawsuit that the teachers filed saying, like, okay, but once you start restarting the schools, we have tenure, we have rights of first refusal for a job. The lower courts ruled in favor of the teachers. The higher court, the appellate court, ruled in favor of the teachers. But there wasn't any money. I mean, it was like, oh, now you owe them $1.5 billion. Well, the public school system in New Orleans didn't have it. One-fifth that kind of money. So, it's just this empty victory that they won. Then there's kind of this period. So right after the storm, 100 out of the 120 or so schools were flooded. Every school was closed in those first months, but slowly schools are coming around. It was so chaotic. I wrote a story recently about the Katrina kids, those who were in school at the time of Katrina and saw at first that government didn't care. They're stuck in this flooded city. The federal government's not rescuing them. And then they're traumatized. They have to come back to these schools. They're changing constantly. You know, so let's start a charter school. Well, this charter school opens, but it closes 2 years later. Now you have to go find another one. People talked about what they needed after Katrina, which is the sense of stability. We liked the neighborhood school. It wasn't perfect, but we knew the teachers. We had a relationship there. The older brother went there. A student was there for a few years, and then Katrina hit, but they're gone. You know, it's no longer a neighborhood system. You're right. It's a 90% plus charter system. You have all these stories of, like, some kid, he's in elementary school, getting up at 6 a.m. in the dark, waiting at a bus stop, you know, to transfer to get to school. It's really this chaotic system that in the last couple of years has finally stabilized. But you have special needs kids. There was a lawsuit, and the public school system had to admit they were failing the special needs kids, because what you saw the charter schools doing is cherry picking. You know, we want certain kinds of students because we want to show that our scores are going up. New Orleans actually the leading suspension rate in the country, and I have to think it's because it was a charter system that wanted to show off how well it was doing and got rid of any kid was expendable if they weren't helping with the numbers.
The mass layoffs of the teachers and paraprofessionals in the school systems, and some people say that the African-American middle class has been shrinking and poverty is increasing. Especially a situation which is really desperate for people, given the fact that living costs are so high.
Right. I mean, New Orleans is a much more expensive city today than it was prior to Katrina. Some of that is housing. Some of it is because the center of town is thriving. You have gentrified neighborhoods. A little bit feels like Brooklyn. There are a few neighbors, so prices, house prices, rents, you know, there's a lot of good that comes with that. You know, the art scene, the restaurant scene, you know, there's a real vibrancy there. But at the same time, it just becomes a more expensive city in what we see. And this statistic is just tragic. So New Orleans has the second highest wealth gap of all American cities. In case you're curious, Atlanta is number one. It's on par. The wealth gap in New Orleans is on par with Zambia in Africa. And the most tragic part is it's getting wider. In the year 2000, the median income for a black family was $30,000 a year in New Orleans. In 2013, that was down to $25,000 for the median black family. Go to white families, it was in the high 40s prior to Katrina. Now it's around 60. They're seeing a growth in the white community, and in the black community is a move backwards. It's because of an inequity among the recovery. I like to say it was not an equal opportunity storm. If you owned a home in New Orleans, you were more than three times more likely to be flooded out by Katrina and the failure of the levees if you're a black homeowner than if you're a white homeowner. And there's racial geography. The whites got to the high ground first. By the time black homeownership was widely available, folks had no choice but to move in the lower-lying areas. So much of the city that flooded, that was heavily the black community. And I mentioned before that all the attention was on homeowners, not renters. Even there was inequity. Let's move up the class ladder to middle class and professional class. They based this program called Road Home, $10 billion program, the largest housing recovery program in U.S. history, an amazing program. And, you know, from the federal government putting forward all this money, they decided to give the money out not based on the cost of rebuilding, not replacement cost to use the insurance term, but based on the assessed value of the home prior to Katrina. And, you know, basically you go neighborhood by neighborhood and you see that the same 2,000 square foot home in a white community is worth twice as much money as one in the black community. So you've got a program that's giving you money based on the assessed value when, of course, all of us know that the price of a home in a black community is typically much lower than one in the white community. And so all these people were left short. A federal judge in 2010, 5 years after Katrina, declared Road Home a racially discriminatory policy. But by that point, of the $10 billion, there was like $150 million left, and it was too late. And so you go to black middle-class neighborhoods, and they're 60, 70% back 10 years after Katrina, and you compare it to Lakeview, a white prosperous community that was flooded after Katrina, it's 100% back. And the reason for that is policy. There was a policy put in place that harmed the black homeowners compared to the white homeowners, and so many black homeowners were left short because of this glitch, mistake, intentional. I'm not sure I could say why it happened, but it did happen, and it's just meant for an unequal recovery post-Katrina.
When I was reading your book, the images that again came to mind reminded me very much of the video, actually, of the death grip of Eric Garner by the police. Here you portray, and suddenly America saw on TV as though it had not existed and we were totally oblivious, the enormity of the poverty, the home split in half by rushing water, the trapped family struggling to flag down help from the rooftops, people who could not leave. They had no resources to do that. People searching for loved ones were swept away by the torrent. This was a case of abject, corrosive poverty on the soul of America. But the response still seems to be, and it unnerves me enormously as the years have passed, people like the darling of the liberal community, Malcolm Gladwell, now, who says in the New Yorker that there really should have been. There should have been a smaller footprint. It's a good thing. And he's talking, of course, about the thousands upon thousands who can't return, whether he realizes it or not. He's talking about the public housing that was needlessly destroyed, that was not damaged by the flood, which assured that poorer people, that people of African ancestry could not stay, would not be able to come back to these neighborhoods. That's so much of the picture and the lessons that I take from Katrina. Am I off base on that?
No, I mean, it's a couple of data points here. So at the time of Katrina, one in four New Orleanians did not own a car. And so on Sunday morning, right, 20 hours before Katrina hits, the mayor, Ray Nagin at the time, declares a mandatory evacuation. Well, you might as well have been saying you're required to take a week off in Aruba. I mean, a mandatory evacuation, but there was no buses, there are no trains, there was no plan to help the disabled, those without cars. And then there's people who had a car, but it was not exactly the most reliable car. And the average cost of evacuating, they estimated, was about $500. This was at the end of the month, August 29th. It was right before school started, or right at the start of school. New Orleans schools start early. And so, it caught people at a time when they didn't exactly have working people, middle-class people, did not have much discretionary income at that moment. So, this idea that you heard at the time, like, well, why didn't they get themselves out? They have the self to blame. It's like, well, how are they supposed to do that? I mean, some had an aunt or a friend, a neighbor who would take them out. But so many were trapped because they had no choice. Another point, the whole shrink the footprint debate was interesting. I was there for 8 months reporting on the storm and its aftermath in the New York Times, and that was my piece. I would go to all these meetings, and, I got it. You had geographers saying, like, hey, listen, this community is 5-8 feet below sea level, and it's vulnerable to this kind of flooding. The flip side of that is something I mentioned before, that, the problem is, who was living in the low-lying neighborhoods and why? So if you went with the plan that the city had put forward, this panel that the mayor had put together, you would have been telling 80% of the black population of New Orleans, I'm sorry, we're not going to rebuild your neighborhoods, but maybe you could find someplace else to live. I mean, it was just this impossible thing to do. But on the other hand, there was never any plan. And so what you see are all these half-built neighborhoods. The Seventh Ward, traditional black working-class neighborhood, bricklayers and clerks in City Hall, that kind of neighborhood. It's a wreck right now. I mean, it was this really stable neighborhood prior to Katrina. I mean, it had its issues, but it was a relatively stable neighborhood with home ownership. And now it's like 50-60% back, and you start to see newcomers to the city, largely white, moving in because, of course, they could get cheap housing there. It's not far from the center of town. Pontchartrain Park, a black middle-class neighborhood, historic neighborhood, a neighborhood that in the 1950s was the first subdivision in New Orleans. Excuse me, in the state of Louisiana, that allowed for black home ownership. It's a tragedy. It's maybe two-thirds back, three-quarters back, 10 years after Katrina. New Orleans East, a black professional class neighborhood with some very, very wealthy parts to it. There's a lot where the African-American lawyers and judges and teachers, medical folks live. It's maybe 80% back 10 years after Katrina. And so we've been stressing kind of the impoverished aspect. I mean, that's what we all saw when we saw Katrina, in the aftermath of Katrina. But it's affected the black middle class and the black professional class. There are 100,000 less African Americans living in New Orleans today than at the time of Katrina. And this was a city of 455,000 at the time. We're talking about a profound change in a city. And yet, I just got back from New Orleans where they were having this celebration more than a commemoration of New Orleans, and you had the mayor, white mayor, you know, doing his victory lap of like, wow, look at the New Orleans miracle that, you know, we're back. In fact, he declared the recovery behind us, and, you know, let's move on. And like, how are they hearing that in these half-built communities?
Gary, the thing that I really thought was just stirring, I have to recommend, because for anyone who cares about poverty, for people who think black life matters, for people who are interested in the role of government in the wealth divide in this country, you really need to read Gary's book, After the Flood. It is an anatomy, or really a picking apart of so many of the hypocrisies and problems, perhaps their most eloquent recitation that exists today. So you really, really need to get that. Finally, in the time that we have left, and I'm really sorry, and I want you to come back just to look at some of the things that you've done so well, the evolution and distribution through the Road Home program, following people from the old line, money millionaires, to the middle class black families in New Orleans East, to the white transplants, to the lower Ninth Ward natives. All of that is part of Gary's writing and books, and so important for people who care about social justice. How do you sum up? What have you learned? What do you want us to learn in the advent of Katrina on this, its 10th anniversary?
You know, I mean, the intentionality. You know, if a disaster happens, a city doesn't come back, I can understand that. You know, if the government had done what they could, but, you know, to cite Malcolm Gladwell's article, he has a long article in The New Yorker, you know, some people found a better life in Houston. You know, they went to better schools for the kids, maybe better health care, maybe they found a better job, whatever it was, and that's great. You found a better life, that's great. What I think is just so tragic about the post-Katrina New Orleans story is that there's so many people who were working hard to get back, and rather than government helping, they got in the way. Or even if government didn't do anything, they just got in the way. The policies they came up with were deliberately made to harm lower income people to come back together. If you don't believe me, there were people saying it. You had white uptown elites, those who, you know, were running the business community, who used to run the city and were very unhappy that a 68% black city was being run by African American leadership. They spoke openly about, this is our chance. This is our chance to change this city, to quote one, demographically, 68% black city, and politically, a black-run city. And by the way, within 5 years, with so many fewer African-Americans there, you had the city's first white mayor in 32 years, a white supermajority on the city council, a white prosecutor replaced a black prosecutor, you know, white police chief, whites were running the public housing and the school system. I mean, I quoted Tulane, a professor who called it the political defeat of Black New Orleans, and I have to think that was right. And again, it was deliberate. It was a deliberate attempt. It wasn't just like, well, okay, people found a better life, so that's all for the best.
Well, they were all betrayed by a political system that was supposed to be accountable to them as citizens, and the abandonment was only the beginning. Once the water receded, the dehumanization, the dehumanizing political events to follow would solidify the sentiment in many ways that no one cared. But we must make it so. Black Life Matters. Gary Rivlin, thank you so much for your extraordinary, important writing. there are so many lessons. I think we should send a free copy to all of the candidates for the presidency. They need a little education. And certainly all of us, let's get it. After the flood, Gary Rivlin, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much, Mimi. Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it.
Another flood in another year. Louisiana, 1927, by Randy Newman.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds roll in from the north and it starts to rain. Rained real hard to rain for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River had busted through, clear down to Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana, Louisiana. Wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. Louisiana, Louisiana. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away. They're trying to wash us away.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Free your vote! Free your vote!
Thank
you, Kim. Thank you, Kim.
She actually thinks she works for God there in the county courthouse when she actually works for Caesar.
She has a right to have her faith accommodated, her convictions accommodated.
This is an attempt to create a drama under this banner of religious freedom, but what it's really about is an attempt to subvert the law and to undermine civil rights.
Hey, this is Kevin Allison of Risk, where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. There's no lull in homophobic assaults in the Ukraine. A Kentucky clerk rebels against court-ordered equality, and a reality podcaster captures humor and pathos. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Marie Gilkison.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending September 5th, 2015. Homophobic thugs attacked two more Ukrainian LGBT venues this week. According to Gay Alliance Ukraine, six masked neo-Nazis stormed into the offices of Queer Home Kriv Bas in the city of Kryvyi Rih on August 30th, throwing smoke bombs and flares into the building and trapping seven staff members inside. They beat one man who tried to stop the attack so mercilessly that he needed immediate hospitalization with what some sources were calling severe life-threatening injuries. The other staff members were treated for smoke inhalation. There was a similar assault the previous day on a cafe in the same city where LGBT activists were hosting a small party. Some 20 masked attackers wearing right-wing regalia forced their way into the cafe and beat up several attendees. 2 weeks ago, masked thugs hurled smoke bombs into a venue in Odessa where LGBT activists were discussing the last-minute ban of a pride march. And six police officers were hurt when extremists tried to stop an LGBT pride parade in Kiev in June. No one has been arrested in any of the recent attacks on LGBT people. Activists claim that police generally refuse to detain suspects who haven't already fled by the time officers arrive. One of the main functions of the state is to protect its citizens, said a media statement from Gay Alliance Ukraine, which demanded that government officials do everything in their power to protect the lives, health, and basic rights of the citizens of Ukraine.
Nine gay men were arrested this week in the Burmese city of Mandalay, even though they hadn't committed any crime. According to a report in Gay Star News, Mint Q, the regional minister of Border and Security Affairs, announced a crackdown on LGBT people and an increased police presence at the city's moat, which the news outlet describes as an oasis for the LGBTI community. Q reportedly said that the nine men were detained after an informant claimed that they were acting inappropriately. He said the men were educated and then released on bond when it was determined that they hadn't broken any law. Graham Reed of Human Rights Watch condemned the detentions in a media release, saying that the Burmese federal government's failure to step in could open the door to more abuse of the sort described by this minister. This is not the first time LGBT people have been under attack in Burma, also known as Myanmar. Plainclothes police officers arrested 10 gay men and transgender women in July 2013 and, according to activists, abused them in detention. Private consensual adult gay sex remains illegal in the Southeast Asian country under a British colonial-era Crimes Against Nature law. Offenders can be punished with up to life in prison.
In other news, queer statistics highlighted reports from four countries this week. An online survey of more than 1,000 self-identified gay and bisexual male teenagers in Japan found more than 40% saying that they've been bullied because of their sexual orientation. 20% reported truancy or self-inflicted injuries as a way of coping. The poll was conducted by a research team led by Yasuharu Hidaka, a professor of social medicine at Takaratsuka University, between August and December last year, and was part of a health ministry research project. Investigators also found that 30% of the respondents said they'd been taught that being a sexual minority was abnormal, a 7% increase from responses to a similar question in a 2005 survey. It is difficult for children who are sexual minorities to signal an SOS, Hidaka told the Asahi Shimbun newspaper, because they are unsure who they can trust enough to talk to. Faculty members should regularly send out positive messages about sexual minorities, he said, to produce an atmosphere that would make it easier for the children to talk to someone about the issue.
Another new survey has found nearly a third of young Israelis don't identify as 100% heterosexual. The MAKO website and Panels Institute asked 600 secular Jews living in Israel to plot themselves on the Kinsey scale, where 0 is exclusively heterosexual and 6 is exclusively homosexual. 85% of the respondents placed themselves at the completely straight extreme of the scale, while 4% put themselves at the exclusively gay end. Of the young Israeli men aged 18 to 24 who participated in the survey, 67% identified as straight, 3% said they're gay, and the remaining 30% put themselves somewhere on the bisexual spectrum. The survey was conducted in late August and has a margin of error of 4%. Recent YouGov polls in both the UK and the US produced similar results. 1 in 2 young adults in the UK and 1 in 3 in the US also don't identify as 100% straight. Those surveys were also conducted in late August and also have a margin of error of 4%. Not surprisingly, the YouGov researchers noted that the older someone is, the less likely they are to say that they have fluid sexual attractions. 24% of people aged 30 to 44 say that they're somewhere on the scale of bisexuality, compared to 8% or less of over 45s.
But the biggest news in the U.S. this week was the continuing drama over marriage licenses in Rowan County, Kentucky.
Thank you, Kim.
After being turned down by the Supreme Court for an extension of a lower appeals court order, County Clerk Kim Davis went to jail on September 3rd rather than allow her signature to be on the marriage certificates of lesbian or gay couples. A self-described born-again Christian, Davis claims that it's her right under the U.S. Constitution to not be forced to act against her religious beliefs. But U.S. District Judge David Bunning ruled that as an elected public official bound to serve every citizen, Davis was violating her oath of office by refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples. She claims to be obeying God's authority, but critics mock David's piety, noting that she's on her fourth marriage. Hundreds of equality advocates chanted, "Love one, love one," as word reached dueling but peaceful crowds outside the courthouse. The judge also ordered all 5 of Davis's deputies, including her son, Nathan, to issue licenses to all applicants while their boss is held in contempt or also face jail if they refuse to comply. A lawyer for Davis, whose defense is funded by the Liberty Council, a right-wing religious rights group, argued that the deputy clerks cannot issue licenses against Davis's authority, but the judge disagreed. And by Friday, September 4th, the first same-gender couples were getting marriage licenses in Rowan County, Kentucky. Davis's son Nathan, however, was the not unexpected holdout. We'll have much more on this story later in the program on most of these same stations.
Elsewhere, Russian authorities abruptly canceled Moscow Premiere, the country's major LGBT film festival, just a few days before the 13th annual edition was scheduled to kick off. A letter from the city's culture committee this week blamed budget constraints, but said that funding would be diverted to a more conventional youth festival of life-affirming film. The cancellation comes 2 years after a so-called no-promo-homo law was enacted by the Putin government, which bans the ill-defined promotion of homosexuality to minors. Moscow Premiere was to have included a week of free screenings of films not given wide release in the country, such as Russia 88, a mockumentary about neo-Nazis, and Winter Journey, a gay-themed debut feature. The shutdown of Moscow Premiere is being seen as part of a wider crackdown on LGBT rights in Russia. The Putin government last week announced plans to entirely block Wikipedia, expanding its efforts to censor anything that could be LGBT supportive on the internet. Authorities shut down the country's major online support group for LGBT or questioning youth, Children 404, in April.
But finally, a love story centered on a gay male couple has become the first such movie to get approval from regulators in China following a year of deliberation and nail-biting by the filmmakers. Seek McCartney, directed by Wang Chao, is a French-Chinese co-production and stars Chinese pop star Han Yong and award-winning French actor Jeremy Alkaim. It's expected to hit theaters later this year. There is no film rating system in China, so all films are expected to be suitable for audiences of all ages. China's media watchdog removed homosexuality from its list of pornographic and vulgar content in 2010. Nevertheless, Brokeback Mountain was banned, as have virtually all other films with gay content, although many are available on video streaming sites. And while it's not a specifically gay-themed film, The Dead End, which features a passionate kiss between 2 male characters, also passed the Chinese censors earlier this year. On his blog, Wang called the approval of Seek McCartney A small step for the regulator and a big step for filmmakers.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending September 5th, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Maria Gilkison.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Something inappropriate may this way come later in the program.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married.
See your job! See your job! See your job! See your job!
An equality-resistant county clerk in Kentucky is getting her 15 minutes of fame. Here's This Way Out's Lucia Chappell.
Rowan County, Kentucky Clerk Kim Davis is in the headlines and in jail after refusing a district court order to issue civil marriage licenses to lesbian and gay couples. The professed born-again Christian claims that God's authority supersedes the U.S. Supreme Court's June marriage equality ruling. Davis says that defying the ruling was a choice between heaven and hell. Pacifica Radio News anchor Mark Miracle covered the September 3rd events.
A defiant county clerk went to jail today for refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay couples, but five of her deputies agreed to issue the licenses themselves, potentially ending the church-state standoff in Rowan County, Kentucky.
I just want you all to know that we are not issuing marriage licenses today.
Why?
Pending.
What appeal is left?
Pending the appeal in the Sixth Circuit.
What's the appeal in the Sixth Circuit?
Has been denied.
Mm-hmm. Right. The injunction is the order that you're supposed to issue marriage licenses.
And we're not issuing marriage licenses.
The Supreme Court denied your stay.
We are not issuing marriage licenses today.
So based on what?
I would ask you all to.
Why are you not issuing marriage licenses today?
Because I'm not.
Under
why?
Whose authority?
Whose authority?
Under God's authority.
U.S. District Judge David Bunning said he had no choice but to jail Kim Davis for contempt after she insisted that her conscience will not allow her to follow federal court rulings on gay marriage. God's moral law conflicts with my job duties, Davis told the judge before she was taken away by a U.S. Marshal. You can't be separated from something that's in your heart and in your soul. Judge Bunning offered to release Davis if she would promise not to interfere with her employees issuing marriage licenses. But Davis, through her attorneys, rejected that offer and chose to stay in jail. Gay and lesbian couples vowed to appear at the Rowan County Clerk's office for the fifth time tomorrow to see if the deputy clerks would keep their promises. As word of Davis's jailing spread outside the federal courthouse, hundreds of people chanted and screamed, love wins, while Davis's supporters booed.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, Kim Davis has got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, Kim Davis has got to go.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Kim.
The wages of sin is death. That is spiritual death. All of you homosexuals are separated from God by your sin. You're spiritually dead in your sins and trespasses.
Davis's lawyer said it was the first time in history an American citizen has been jailed for believing that marriage is a union between one man and one woman. He compared her willingness to accept imprisonment to what Martin Luther King Jr. did to advance civil rights. Davis is represented by the Liberty Council, which advocates in court for religious freedom.
The issue was that from the time that she began, marriage has always been one thing, and it's been between a man and a woman.
Matt Staver.
2 months ago, that changed, and so the job duties changed. The fact of the matter is that she has a right to have her faith accommodated, her convictions accommodated. The Supreme Court has never said that your right requires someone to actually participate in your particular conviction or your belief or your activity.
Before she was led away, Davis said the U.S. Supreme Court ruling legalizing same-sex marriage nationwide conflicts with the vows that she made when she became a born-again Christian.
That report by Pacifica Radio's Mark Miracle. While Davis sat in jail, all her deputies began issuing civil marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples on September 4th. All that is except her own son, Nathan. The judge is apparently not penalizing him for his noncompliance. On his radio show this week, the Family Research Council's Brian Fisher compared Davis to World War II Nazi resistors and U.S. abolitionists.
Think about Dred Scott, 1857. They said the Negro has no rights that the white man is bound to respect. Fugitive slave law, you find a fugitive slave in a free state, you got to capture him, you got to apprehend him, you got to take him into custody, and you got to send him back home to his slave master. What would we think if you had a lower court judge, a magistrate, in, let's say, in Wisconsin that said, you know, I'm not going to sign that warrant. You want me to sign a warrant to go kidnap or capture a fugitive slave and return him to slavery? I'm not going to do it, even though the Supreme Court says that that Negro has no rights. I think we would regard that guy today as a hero, and that's how I look at Kim Davis.
Evan Wolfson of the victoriously retiring advocacy group Freedom to Marry would beg to differ with Brian Fisher's analysis. As Wolfson told MSNBC,
this is not a question of religious freedom. She has religious freedom. No one's telling her what to believe, what to think, what to do. But she took an oath to do a job. In fact, she draws an $80,000 a year taxpayer salary to do a job. If she doesn't feel she can do the job consistent with her conscience, she is free to resign. She has been given an order by a federal judge. She tested that order all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld what this judge instructed her to do. The judge brought her back into court to give her a chance to comply with the law. She deliberately chose to defy that law and indeed tried to interfere with her deputies performing the law. This is an attempt to create a drama under this banner of religious freedom, but what it's really about is an attempt to subvert the law and to flout civil rights and undermine civil rights, and it's completely intolerable, particularly in a government employee.
Rabble-rousing activist and writer Dan Savage emphasized on MSNBC that Kim Davis is a public servant.
Kim Davis, as John Corvino wrote today in the Detroit Free Press, and I think he said it best, is being asked to administer the law, which is her job. She's not being asked to perform a sacrament. She's tasked with ascertaining that the people in front of her, the couple standing in front of her, have a legal right to get married and to provide them with that license. She is not a minister. She actually thinks she works for God there in the county courthouse when she actually works for Caesar.
Savage is not alone in his skepticism about Davis's zeal for martyrdom.
I actually think Kim Davis does wish to be a martyr, and I think Kim Davis is waiting to cash in. I predicted from the beginning that she would defy all the court orders, defy the Supreme Court. She would ultimately be held in contempt of court, lose her job, perhaps go to prison for a short amount of time, and then she will have written for her ghostwritten book. She will go on the right-wing lecture circuit, and she'll never have to do an honest day's work ever again in her life. This is about someone hypocritically cashing in, and she is a hypocrite. She said today, and I'm going to read it because I want to make sure I get it right, I never imagined a day like this would come where I would be asked to violate a central teaching of Scripture and of Jesus himself regarding marriage. This is a woman who has been divorced 3 times and married 4 times, and I'm going to read this to you. She gave birth to twins 5 months after divorcing her first husband. They were fathered by her 3rd husband, but adopted by her 2nd husband. She's now on to her 4th husband. Jesus Christ himself in Scripture condemns divorce, calls it adultery, and forbids it. Jesus Christ himself in Scripture says not one word about same-sex marriage. We live in a pluralistic, multicultural, multi-faith, multi-denominational, within faiths society, and it would be utter chaos if everyone was empowered to cite God's authority to violate the law or break the law.
The chaos Dan Savage envisions may be coming. Since North Carolina enacted a law allowing state magistrates to decline to perform weddings, more than 30 have done so. Similar exemptions in other states could be on the horizon. And MSNBC's Rachel Maddow noticed another disturbing trend.
This one Kentucky clerk is the one who's getting all this attention for this fight right now. I think it's also very important to note that she may not be alone. By our best figuring today, there appear to be clerks who have said they will basically take this same stance as this clerk in Rowan County in 14 counties in Alabama. Also, 2 more counties in Kentucky besides the one where the clerk is now in jail, plus 1 county in Texas. If that figuring is correct, that means we're looking at 17 more potential cases like the one unfolding today in Kentucky where the clerk has ended up in jail. We do know how this ends, ultimately. This ends with marriage equality everywhere. We have known it would end that way since the United States Supreme Court ruled on this issue and settled this as a matter of law this summer. But what is the prospect of these jailed anti-gay wannabe martyrs what is the prospect of not just one of them, but more than a dozen of them, due to the politics of this issue?
That was MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. Lawyers for Kim Davis filed a notice of appeal on September 6th, challenging the contempt ruling that sent her to jail. She vows to remain behind bars, saying she gets comfort from reading her Bible. Meanwhile, up to 500 supporters prayed and protested on September 5th outside the Kentucky jail where Davis is being held. But denied marriage license applicant David Moore told Democracy Now! He thinks that support is soft.
If she would issue marriage licenses today to everyone, those people who are coming out to say, we stand with Kim Davis, they would not be protesting. They would not be protesting people just going and getting their license. She is basically sending like a rallying signal that she's a victim, and she's not a victim. So really it's just this false signal, oh, come and help me, so all these people show up. But really she doesn't need any help because her rights haven't been changed or taken away in any way whatsoever.
Kim Davis and her supporters are waiting for the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, Ohio, to rule on her request to set aside Judge Bunning's original ruling in the case. However, the appeals court said that she had little chance of winning when it initially denied her request for a stay, which was upheld by the Supreme Court. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series, and you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
Hey, this is Kevin Allison of the live show and audio podcast Risk, where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share.
So we say that nothing is inappropriate until maybe something is.
Despite the risk involved, This Way Out correspondent Dixie Trickle sat down for an interview with Out comic and storyteller Kevin Allison when his podcast was on tour in Minneapolis. She asked him how he got started.
I was in a sketch comedy group called The State on MTV in the early 90s. We did sketch comedy along the lines of Saturday Night Live or Monty Python. I was the only gay member. I was out of the closet, actually, when I was 24 years old in 1994. After The State broke up in 96, I spent about 12 years doing crazy, kooky characters on stage and was kind of getting nowhere with my solo career. And people kept saying to me, oh, well, why don't you, you know, get up on stage and just tell your own true stories, just be yourself? And I would say, oh, but I'm so odd. I mean, I'm a mix of things that don't seem to go together in a way that Hollywood might understand. I'm too gay and yet too friendly and Midwestern and polite and yet too kind of kinky and raunchy sometimes and yet kind of too serious and spiritual at other times. So it seems like a strange combination. I said, it seems too risky.
Were you inspired by particular comedians?
For me, I developed a sort of defense mechanism when I was in kindergarten and the first grade. I thought, oh, I'm so afraid of people finding out that I like boys, that why don't I try to be funny? That way people will know I'm quote-unquote weird, but it's okay. I kind of obsessed over this idea of coming out, how to do that. And that's why I've created Risk. It was my friend Michael Ian Black who said to me, if it seems risky to be yourself because things that feel risky are often, you know, you're opening up in such a way that the audience will open up to you. So I created a podcast called Risk, where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share in public. People are completely uncensored. They can come out about anything. So some of the stories are hilarious, and some of them are absolutely shocking, horrifying, or really profoundly beautiful. It's all over the emotional map.
Where do the people come from that are on your show, Risk?
Well, originally, because I had my start in comedy, I just asked a lot of comedians. So we had people originally on, like, Margaret Cho or Janine Garofalo or Mark Maron, Lisa Lampanelli, people like that. And what eventually happened was that some of the sharing on the show became so profound and really started having a cathartic effect on the people listening to the podcast that people started writing into me. And they would write in things like, I was really struggling with a heroin addiction and I'd like to talk about that. Or I was molested when I was a child. Or sometimes they'd write in with something that was just absolutely ridiculous that happened to them. That's just hilarious to talk about. It was the audience of the show that picked up on, oh, here's what this can continue to be, anyone sharing. You know, in my later years, I came out as other things. I came out as being, for example, like kinky or someone who is non-monogamous. And I know a lot of friends who have come out as being trans when they originally came out as just being gay. To me, it's interesting that life itself is a process of coming out.
You're a comedian, I know, but mm-hmm. You sound more like a storyteller.
Yeah.
You know, someone who loves to hear people's stories and tell stories.
In the, I would say 6 years now that I've been doing Risk, I've pretty much only been doing storytelling. To me, what's so interesting is I feel like we're always wearing a mask of some sorts, you know? Even when we do break down the wall a little bit, take off a mask, we might feel like, well, I'm still wearing a little bit of another mask. It's kind of like the dance of the seven veils. We eventually take a little bit more off and a little bit more off. And it's kind of finding out more and more of who we are. I remember seeing The Times of Harvey Milk when I was a little kid and him emphasizing it's so important for more and more and more of us to come out to our families, to our friends. Because when they just hear that the people that they love and the people that they know have these stories that they've been living through, there's something that's very healing and bringing people back to a holistic way that we used to communicate with each other in storytelling.
Podcaster Kevin Allison was interviewed by Dixie Trykle. You can check him out at risk-show.com. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michelle Marie Gilkison, Wenzel Jones, Lucia Chappelle, and Dixie Trykle contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Thanks also this week to Mark Miracle and Pacifica Radio News. John Williams performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentham, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on CJSF Burnaby, British Columbia, KRCL Salt Lake City, Utah, WLRI Christiana, Pennsylvania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
today on Against the Grain. She says we've moved beyond neoliberalism to a new modality or stage of capitalism, one in which almost all the opportunities are handed to a select group and the risks are downloaded on to the rest of us. I'm C.S. Song. The political theorist Albena Osmanova describes what she considers to be the fourth incarnation of capitalism, aggregative capitalism, after these news headlines with Eileen Alfandari.
Opponents of the Iran nuclear deal rallied against it outside the U.S. Capitol, even as they faced almost certain defeat on the issue in Congress. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump told the crowd of Tea Party and pro-Israel activists to get used to winning if he becomes president. Presidential candidate and Senator Ted Cruz warned of the consequences should the deal ultimately be adopted.
Number one, the Obama administration will become, quite literally, the world's leading financier of radical Islamic terrorism.
Speaking at the Brookings Institution in Washington, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton offered her most vigorous endorsement yet of the deal between Iran and six world powers.
Is it perfect? Well, of course not. No agreement like this ever is. But is it a strong agreement? Yes, it is. And we absolutely should not turn it down.
President Obama has enough votes lined up to overturn a congressional vote of disapproval. The California Assembly may vote today on a bill to legalize physician aid in dying for the terminally ill. The controversial end-of-life options measure won passage in a special legislative session committee weeks after a nearly identical bill seemed to be dead for the year. It already has won passage in the state Senate. The measure would let some adults with a terminal diagnosis ask their doctors for drugs to end their lives. It's modeled on a death with dignity law in Oregon. Opponents include disability rights and Catholic groups and advocates for the poor. They warn that choice would be a myth in a profit-driven healthcare system where assisted death could be the cheapest treatment option. Federal regulators are halting a five-year study of the risk of cancer in communities around six U.S. nuclear power plants, including in California and a nuclear fuel site. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission said remaining work on a pilot study would take too long and cost too much. In Seattle, teachers went on strike today for the first time in 30 years. The first day of school was canceled. Teachers were walking the picket lines after last-minute negotiations over wages and other issues broke down last night. Salty foods from sandwiches to salads will soon come with a first-of-its-kind warning label at chain restaurants in New York City. The City Board of Health voted unanimously to require chain eateries to put salt shaker symbols on menus to denote dishes with more than the recommended daily limit of 2,300 milligrams of sodium. That's about a teaspoon. New York is the first U.S. city with such a requirement, which comes as officials and experts urge people to eat healthier. The average U.S. consumer takes in about 3,400 milligrams of salt each day. Only about 1 in 10 meets the 1 teaspoon guideline. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker today called on EU countries to agree by next week to share 160,000 refugees among them, warning that Greece, Italy, and Hungary can no longer cope with the crisis alone. In an impassioned appeal at the European Parliament in Strasbourg, France, Juncker unveiled a list of new proposals to help Europe confront its biggest refugee emergency since World War II.
Turning a blind eye to poor and helpless people, that is not Europe.
Juncker added the refugee crisis will not simply go away. The refugee crisis has sparked fierce debate in France, with far-right National Front leader Marine Le Pen leading opposition to opening the French borders. Secretary of State John Kerry said the U.S. will allow more refugees into the United States. Kerry didn't give any specifics on the number of additional refugees the U.S. may be willing to take. The U.S. has only taken in 1,500 Syrian refugees over the course of nearly 5 years of war in Syria. I'm Eileen Alfandari. News returns at 4 with headlines. Please join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News, and you can follow us on Twitter at KPFA News.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Perhaps you've heard on this program one or two or many political economists say that neoliberalism first emerged in the 1970s, that it's characterized by privatization, deregulation, and trade liberalization, and that neoliberalism remains the form of capitalism we're in today. Well, we've got a different story to tell you this hour, or I should say the story will be told by a European political theorist named Albena Osmanova. Albena is an associate professor in social and political thought at the University of Kent's Brussels School of International Studies in Belgium, and she's currently a visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley. She's also the author of The Scandal of Reason, A Critical Theory of Political Judgment. Albena Osmanova believes that we're in the fourth historical modality of capitalism, the first three being the entrepreneurial capitalism of the 19th century, the capitalism of the post-World War II welfare state, and the neoliberal capitalism of the late 20th century. She assigns great importance to the degree to which each version of capitalism gained legitimacy, and also to the way each doled out risks and opportunities. Albena calls the current stage of capitalism, which she says began well before the recent economic meltdown, she calls it aggregative capitalism. When Albena sat down with me recently in studio, I noted that she'd recently written that capitalism's prospects have rarely seemed gloomier, and I asked her to elaborate.
Yes, we seem to be approaching a revolutionary moment about 2010. And it is not simply because the financial crisis turned into economic crisis, turned into social crisis through unemployment, and many people's lives were wrecked. But there was more. There were elites were aware that there was a big moment of change, of mistrust in capitalism. Even the Financial Times, this bastion of capitalist intellectual life, pronounced capitalism on its deathbed. It wrote, it commented on David Harvey's book on the crisis of capitalism, The Enigma of Capital and the Crisis of Capitalism. It described it as a deftly timed call for the overthrow of capitalism. So we had also such movements as Occupy and the Indignados in Spain and the protest in Greece. So there seemed to be a momentum of a consensus that many forces were uniting in their withdrawing their support to democratic capitalism as we knew it. Moreover, there were many people, especially sociological studies, surveys, revealed that growing numbers of people were declaring that they did not want this life. What I mean are that even at the best jobs, the best paid jobs, the most satisfying jobs, were declaring that there is so much work pressure, so much stress related to work, that what they wanted is a better balance between work, not just work-family, as we used to bang about, but work, family, and leisure. So a growing number of people, the poor and the rich, across the political spectrum, seem to be coming to an awareness that this model should go, is ready to go. Even in policy circles, politicians, wise academics, were discussing that the neoliberal policies of deregulation, liberalization, open markets are what brought this crisis on us and had to be changed. However, and here is the paradox, voters, although they had declared in surveys that they wanted to live differently, that they were ready to valorize, to value, and to produce their life and to live their life differently, voters in the Western Europe especially, at the nadir of the economic crisis, 2008-2009, they voted for the economically liberal parties that actually brought the economy to its knees.
Now, why is that? I mean, does that signify the lack of an alternative? in terms of parties and candidates in Western Europe, or is there some other factor?
I'm ready to claim that there are alternatives, and I'm ready even to discuss them. But to come to the point of explaining this paradox that there was no this second movement against markets. You might remember how Karl Polanyi was describing that counter-movement against the self-regulating market that grew gradually from all kinds of social forces in the 19th century and ended up with the welfare state of the second after the Second World War. So Karl Polanyi was, in The Great First Transformation, in his book, was describing not only that there is the working class, but also merchants, bankers, the socialists, the conservative parties, they were all pushing for social protection against this movement. Now elites are pressing with the same policies, but also social protest is phrased in a very conservative manner. What I found heartbreaking was watching this, the indignados in Spain, these beautiful, inspired young people who are seeing, you know, their future going away as unemployment in Spain was among the young was going up to 40-50%. Their slogan was, "We're not against the system is against us." This is deeply conservative, even reactionary in nature. We want, you know, better capitalism. We don't want an overhaul of the model. So you ask me, why is that? And to answer that question, I still want to remind us of something missing. What is missing? Remember what happened in 68. Okay, in 68, in the 60s, there was a radical imagination. The students at the Sorbonne in Paris, they were not saying we're not against the system is against us. They had slogans such as be realistic, believe in the impossible. So there was a viable alternative social imaginary, which we're missing now. So this paradox is what we need to understand. And my answer is that while we have been debating, fearing, or celebrating the crisis of capitalism, capitalism has meanwhile transformed, mutated into a new modality, which, according to the book I'm writing now about the four lives and times of capitalism, followed the liberal capitalism of the 19th century, the so-called social capitalism, organized capitalism of the after the Second World War, the neoliberal capitalism of the late 20th century. And so I'm arguing that we have entered in the fourth type of capitalism, which is even darker and more exploitative and more destructive to human nature and to natural resources than neoliberal capitalism.
Well, let's lay a foundation for your explanation, your description of what kind of capitalism we are in today by going back to the first phase, the first kind, the first modality of capitalism, which, as you said, is called liberal or entrepreneurial capitalism. What were the main features of this kind of capitalism, which I take it prevailed in the 19th century?
Well, typically, there the state or the public authority was trying to create the legal framework for to enable people to undertake new production, to undertake, to become capitalist, to engage in the production of goods and services. So the way it was done was through securing contract law, private property, and the state didn't do much more than that. Then it unleashed a process of the proletarization of the working class. We're familiar with that story. So the freedom of enterprise at that time was coupled with its dark side. Well, freedom of enterprise, including what John Locke celebrated as freedom of human creativity expressed in the production, in the launching of new products and new services. But the dark side of that, of course, was the commodification of labor and all the wreckage it did to human nature and to societies.
So this would be called laissez-faire capitalism?
It's laissez-faire capitalism, exactly.
And you focus in your writings on an interesting relationship that not a lot of people articulate between risk and opportunity. So in what ways were risk and opportunity correlated in this first phase of capitalism?
Right. The relationship between risk and opportunity, or the correlation, has much to do with the capacity of capitalism to legitimate itself. We are often being told a story that massive support for capitalism comes from its promise to create wealth for everyone. There is this fundamental belief in the spirit that supports capitalism that whoever undertakes a risk, for instance, investing of resources into launching a new product, they're entitled to the opportunity they're rewarded with wealth. So capitalism is a fair play only when it correlates properly risk and opportunity. And much of the popular support to that, apart from the creation of wealth for society, is based on this. Because if wealth is not created in this fair way, it stops to be acceptable to people.
So in this first phase, was there a kind of correlation between risk and opportunity that legitimated that phase of capitalism in people's eyes?
Well, theoretically, it was supposed to do so, but of course it didn't play out to be so, because nobody imagined at the launching of capitalism that it would create so much wreckage in terms of the exploitation of child labor, women being tasked with production that they could not bear, long working hours, and what it did to human nature. So as these kind of risks became more obvious, society reacted. And as I said, this reaction did not come just from the workers who are mobilizing against capital. If we do trust this splendid narrative of Karl Polanyi about Britain at that time, actually, there were, you know, even the merchants and banks and all kinds of social forces, including the Catholic Church, which started to resist that and said, this is a social risk that is too much and something needs to be done. And this is exactly what the welfare state after the Second World War accepted as its legitimate function, to offset social risk by spreading a social safety net, such as limitation to working hours, limitation to working lives, pensions, healthcare, in Europe, free education. So then risk and opportunities aligned, and there was this pact, this social contract underpinning democratic capitalism that lasted for about 30 years.
Albena Osmanova joins me in studio on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. She is associate professor in social and political thought at the University of Kent at Brussels, Belgium. She's currently a visiting scholar at University of California, Berkeley. Okay, so in the first phase of capitalism, there's a stress on freedom of enterprise under individual initiative, the autonomy of the individual. Then, as you say, after World War II, another kind of capitalism, what's called organized capitalism, came into play. So are you saying that under this second modality of capitalism, the focus was on, in a sense, protecting society from the market, protecting it from what the market had done to society in earlier years and decades?
Exactly. There was this mass shared belief that the state had social responsibility. It had to offset the social risks of capital, of the game of capitalistic creation of profit. But probably that protection went even too far. Forces even on the left, such as the Frankfurt School people, Frankfurt School, this is a school of thought that emerged in Frankfurt around the 30s, started to criticize this capitalism for being too bureaucratic, for crushing the human soul. You might remember there is this line in a song from Janis Joplin about those times. You took away not only our rights, but also our wrongs. Individuals were crushed under the bureaucratic logic of this welfare capitalism, which, remember, it was called the nanny state. So if we, in the first formation of capitalism, if you call the state, I call it teenager state in one publication, because the state tries to enable the teenager to launch its independent life. In the second stage, the nanny state is telling us what to do and what not to do, how to be happy. So there was not only critique from the right that this deal between labor and capital underpinning democratic capitalism was inefficient because it put constraints on capital, but on the left, the criticism was that it was crushing individual initiative. It was crushing our freedoms. So this format of the social contract started to come under pressure both from the left and the right around the 70s.
And so what happened in the 70s such that the modality, the form, the kind of capitalism shifted to what we now call neoliberal capitalism?
I will not explain the crisis of the 70s. We are all aware of that. But, of course, political answers to crisis can vary. The answer was privatization. By then, a lot of the key economies of Europe were in public hands, especially infrastructure, gas and electricity. All the important companies were in state hands, so privatization, then deregulation of the economy, you know, lifting the regulatory limits to expansion of capitalist enterprise, which eventually, towards the end of the 20th century, allowed many companies to exploit rent, because competition, if you're not exposed to competition, you are in a privileged position. That is, the risk opportunity balance doesn't play anymore for you. You have less risk because you're exposed to less competition, and you reap the benefits, the opportunities for wealth creation much more. And the third trajectory was market openness. So endorsing globalization. Remember, the late of the 90s were a decade of increased integration of national markets into the global economy. So we have these three trajectories: privatization, deregulation, and opening of markets to global competition that launched the neoliberal formation.
And what happened to the government's focus in the earlier modality of capitalism on taking care of people, providing for their welfare, protecting them from the market?
Now, the state under this third formation, and I call that state the stepmother state, it plays a hands-off game. It pushes, also through regulation, but it pushes more of the responsibility for social integration, for national security, to the market. And also it pushes responsibility to individuals. We had all to become responsible not only for finding employment with the new policy of labor market activation, it is called, not only to find employment, but to stay employable. Workers were pushed to, if they couldn't find a job, they had to undergo training, they had to stay employable all the time. But this responsibility was pushed onto individuals. We all had to start drinking our carrot juice and do our jogging before we enter the companies and become more efficient and better workers. So what this neoliberal state does is takes a distance, but still supervise society and push more responsibility to the citizens. Interestingly, public expenditure did not shrink. Social services, expenditure on social services and on redistribution went down, but the state invested a lot, especially in disciplinary policy, in surveillance, safety, also in the taking care of the general public, building parks. In Spain, there was a lot of investment in the tourist industry, building museums and parks. But if you notice what is happening here, the state is not offsetting the risk. It is no longer, it is taking generally care of the public, but is not offsetting the risk that is accumulating to those with least chances to profit from this global openness and free markets.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Albana Osmanova joins me. She teaches political and social theory at the University of Kent's Brussels Schools in International Studies. That's in Belgium. Her most recent book is The Scandal of Reason, A Critical Theory of Political Judgment. And her research and writing focuses on democratization, social justice, sustainable development, the EU Constitution, and the transformation of political ideologies. So, Albana, you're describing some of the main features of the neoliberal capitalist state, to which I say, and to which really probably the majority of commentators on this program have said, well, that's what we're still in. We're still in this era of order and securitization. We're still in this era of responsibilities being downloaded onto the individual. The individual now has to sort of take care of himself or herself and project him or herself into the job market. We're still in this kind of harsh treatment of society and the lack of government support for social services. So in what sense are you arguing that we've moved really kind of beyond neoliberalism into something else?
Yes, I'm not saying that there's a rupture among all these modalities. Their configuration of the same repertoire of capitalism, of competitive production of profit. However, I find that it is no longer helpful to talk about neoliberal capitalism, although all of these things are still there because something else is also happening, which has very deep implications. So there is a new function of the public authority. And this new function is a redistributive one. So the state no longer administers only this provision of safety and public service while individuals are left on themselves to cope with employment and social integration. But the state, under the pressures or under the excuse of global economic integration, the monster of globalization, has taken on itself to increase the opportunities for those who already have a competitive advantage, such as banks, big companies, big corporations, and outsource the risk to society. So the state has taken an active role of redistribution, but not to offset risk, actually to accumulate the risk to society and to advantage even further those with a competitive advantage. Why? Because there is this policy dogma of national competitiveness in the global market. Now, if in the previous formations, when, let's say, when the Bretton Woods system was set up after the Second World War, the wealthy democracies, they established this global market openness of their economies in the hope that this would help growth and redistribution. So globalization then, or global market openness, was a condition for that old game that underpinned democratic capitalism of growth and redistribution and creating happy consumers and happy workers. Since the year 2000, and I'm more familiar with the European context, global economic integration and therefore global competitiveness has become a policy dogma that trumps everything else. It is the policy priority. For instance, the European Union adopted the so-called Lisbon Agenda in year 2000, pledging to make the European economy by year 2020 the most competitive economy in the global market. And there have been reiterations of that policy agenda too by now, where this priority becomes ever more visible and important. So, in the name of national competitiveness, the state is not only withdrawing redistribution, its redistributive functions from the previous formations, from the previous incarnations of capitalism, but is redistributing to those who already have opportunities.
Does this tie into the rhetoric we often heard about, you know, too big to fail, there are these banks and we can't let them fail because they're so important, maybe not just to the national economy, but to the international economy?
Absolutely. And people became aware of that, but these things were happening already before. For instance, in the European Union, countries were pushing to create national champions by making finances or giving tax breaks to companies. Let me give an example of one very strange policy. For instance, when Nicolas Sarkozy was French president, in order to stimulate the economy, he issued by decree that all workers should be given a bonus of €1,000. However, not all workers, only the workers in the biggest companies listed on the so-called CAC 40 list of the French stock exchange. So this is another example of giving push to those who already have a competitive advantage for the sake of motivating those workers to work even better in those companies on which the French success in the global economy was dependent. And actually, there are more and more complaints at the European Court of Justice concerning state aid to economic companies. So this precedes the economic crisis. This is my point, that this new modality of capitalism was not created by the crisis. It was consolidated by the crisis. I see its genesis at around the turn of the century.
So if the state is then helping, it's actually privileging, giving privilege treatment to certain workers, for example, in that French example you just mentioned, and is giving privilege treatment to only certain companies and firms that it sees as key to keeping the nation's economy competitive in the global capitalist system, then what does that do to the strong temptation a lot of people on the left would have of saying that capital is the winner and labor is the loser in this new form of capitalism?
Well, the labor-capital clash that was defining a lot of the politics of the 20th century no longer holds, exactly because there is a labor-capital alliance in specific sectors of the economy. Small businesses are losing out of the competition against the big businesses because they cannot profit from their exposure to the competitive pressures of the global economy. So this is probably the curse, that labor is divided and capital is divided. So these coalitions in favor of the new formation of capitalism that I call aggregative capitalism, because the risks and opportunities are aggregated to specific players, this cuts across labor and capital, and that has been the problem of the left.
That's Albena Osmanova. She is associate professor in social and political thought at the University of Kent at Brussels, Belgium. We have a link on our website to her faculty page there, as well as to her book, The Scandal of Reason, A Critical Theory of Political Judgment, as well as to her co-edited volume, Reclaiming Democracy, Judgment, Responsibility, and the Right to Politics. We'll take a short break and speak more with Albena. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song, and joining me in studio is Albena Asmanova. She teaches political and social theory at the University of Kent's Brussels School in International Studies in Belgium, and she's currently a visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley. So we were talking earlier about not just capitalist systems or capitalist formations, but also the legitimacy of such formations in the eyes of the people, in the eyes of people whose obedience capitalist systems depend on in order to run smoothly. So if we look at the legitimacy of the current, in your view, system of aggregative capitalism, what should be said about the degree to which people see this government, this kind of public authority, as legitimate and as either worth supporting or worth mobilizing against?
This is exactly the paradox. Risks and opportunities are clearly no longer aligned. So there's a complete disbalance. Public authority is implementing more and more policies for market efficiency, creating huge risk for society, but doing nothing to offset that risk. So we should be having a revolution because the legitimacy of the system is gone, but this is not happening. And this has been my effort to understand and explain. So let me try in this way. Not every social grievance, social unhappiness, discomfort, not all of these, the hurt of society is translated as a political claim. This is what I call that we need to pay attention to this process of politicization. And this process of politicization of the social discomfort into a political protest is mediated or passes through what people perceive as political deliverables. That is, public authority should provide these things to society because they're desirable, for instance, such as social safety net, less risk, less exposure to global market pressures, less stress on the job. So these deliverables have two features. They're desirable, but also populations must think that these things are possible, that public authority can actually deliver them. And what surveys have showed that the more the market is open, the more a national market is open, the less the electorate in these countries holds elites responsible for economic policy and therefore for the social consequences of that policy. Basically, in the context of global economic competition, people have given up the hope, the expectation that public authority can do something about economic policy and social policy. And basically, citizens have absolved public authority from social responsibility effectively. And of course, there is the story that we have all become brainwashed into obedient workers and consumers. But I take my distance from those critics of neoliberal capitalism. There is much of that going on, but people are not so stupid. There is something else going on, and this is that as people have become more responsible for their employability, but also as this global economic competition is putting a pressure on everybody to work more for the sake of keeping the job. And what is a job? It is our livelihood. We have no more sources for maintaining a lifestyle or even providing for our basic needs than the job. So this is what I describe as the main contradiction of contemporary capitalism. If you think of it, technological progress is amazing. It's just magnanimous advancement of technological process. Keynes wrote in 1930 an article called The Economic Prospects of Our Grandchildren, saying that within 100 years, easily, our technological development would be so advanced that we would take one-third of the time we take now, back then, in the 30s, to satisfy our basic needs. So people should have much more leisure and much less being hooked to this capitalist process of production and redistribution and consumption. But this is not happening exactly because the jobs for everybody have become insecure, not just for the people with the bad and poorly paid jobs, but also for the people with the good jobs, the labor market insiders. So this is the contradiction of contemporary capitalism, that we have this unprecedented opportunity for decommodification, that is, for no longer of having a human life depend on having a job, on being hooked into the economy. But the pressures for commodification, that is to stay employed and employable for absolutely everybody, what I call the 99% who don't want to be in, but they must be in order to survive, these pressures have also increased magnanimously. And it is the fear of losing a job, the fear of falling behind, that is making people more conservative, although they feel the discomfort of this life of wasting our creativity into jobs that a lot of people dislike, or even if you like, you don't want to be spending all your life on that job. So those pressures are making people more conservative rather than more liberated to indulge in a imagination for alternative lives.
But wouldn't greater insecurity, economic insecurity, job insecurity, wouldn't that incline people to ask more of government, to say, look, government, you need to come in and do something and make our lives better? There's a history of this to some degree in under capitalism. Can you do this now?
Well, sure, it makes sense. But let's see why it is not happening. I believe it should be happening, and this is what a renewed left should be taking this discourse. But what's happening on the left is, see, both on the left and this alternative right movements are appealing to the democratization of everyday life, and they're being captured by this neoliberal discourse of absolving the state from responsibilities in the name of democracy. So actually the left is compounding the problem rather than offering a solution. We need to pressure public authority, and that's not on the state level in Europe. I believe public authority on the level of the European Union to do more social protection, to create what I call the economy of trust.
But in what ways is the rhetoric of democracy, for example, in Europe, taking pressure off of public authorities, absolving them of some kind of responsibility in people's eyes to take care of the populace?
When we say a democracy, we mean self-government. So it's a very easy move, logical move, to say we are responsible for our existence. We have to take care of our lives. Let me give you an example. So the Council of Europe adopted recently a charter for shared social responsibility. And I participated in some of the discussions as the charter was elaborated. And there in the drafts, I noticed this very prominent discourse that as the state cannot fulfill its social responsibilities anymore because it doesn't have the means, we all have to become more responsible for our well-being. So to be good Democrats, we have to take more responsibility and share responsibility. The poor have to become responsible for their poverty and so on. So it's a very dangerous move to absolve the state from responsibility in the name of self-government, in the name of democracy. Why? Why is that? Simply because social existence is a very complex thing. You cannot make people responsible for things that they cannot effectively be responsible for. This only creates fear, and we indulge on the logic of escape from freedom out of fear, as we see the mobilization of this new populism, both from the left and the right. People are afraid for the loss of their livelihoods, and they're expressing that concern, that legitimate concern, in the wrong way. Back to my point about the politicization, that very legitimate grievance, which the left should actually address, is being instead politicized, expressed in the political terms of xenophobia, a fear of the stranger, of Islamophobia now, the upsurge of Islamophobia, I believe, is very much part of this larger economic anxiety.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Her name is Albena Osmanova. She is normally based in Brussels, Belgium, at the University of Kent's Brussels School in International Studies, where she teaches social and political theory. She is author of The Scandal of Reason, A Critical Theory of Political Judgment, and her new book is, she's a co-editor of the volume, Reclaiming Democracy, Judgment, Responsibility, and the Right to Politics. So hearing you talk about sort of this crisis of social mobilization, or I should say the lack of social mobilization against the status quo, because that's what we're trying to explore here partly, which is why aren't people rising up and revolting against this revolting system, this latest iteration of capitalism? Many people, and I'm going to bring it up here, would point to challenges to austerity, notably in Greece, for example, with the ascendance of the leftist Syriza party. You have other formations like Podemos in Spain. I mean, do you see these as challenges to the current political economic status quo?
These formations, and I really sympathize with Syriza, but to be fair, what they do very well is opening the horizon of possibilities, reclaiming what I call our right to politics. We cannot accept this dogma that there is no alternative Tina logic that Margaret Thatcher launched back in the 80s and has remained valid till now. We all told that there are no alternatives to the politics of austerity and deregulation, liberalization of labor markets and product markets. So what the social protest has done a good job on is to open that horizon, to break that horizon and say, no, there are alternatives. So they're reclaiming a very important right we didn't know we had before we lost it, and this is the right to politics. However, they're not advocating a radical overhaul of the model within which we want less austerity, of the model in which we want more equality. This is what is not being questioned. And maybe I should explain what I mean, because it seems important to me in what way we should be looking for alternatives. Now let's take the critique of capitalism that we inherited from Marx and Georg Lukács. There are two trajectories in which Marx describes oppression and domination and injustice. The injustice of exploitation. The worker is weaker vis-a-vis the capitalist because the worker doesn't have the resources, doesn't have the ownership of the means of production. So this is what I call relational inequality. Some people have less power than others, so they're unequal within a certain model of well-being. But Marx also wrote about alienation, and this is not the same logic in which people suffer, because alienation is brought about by the submission of absolutely everybody, even of those who own the means of production, the capitalists, the bourgeoisie, the enemy. Even these people are submitted to the productivist imperative and pressures of capitalism. So when Marx describes that alternative way of being, when you are in the morning a fisherman and you are a worker in the afternoon and you are an intellectual in the evening, this model of having a fuller life, that means that we need changes both on the level of the relational but also on what I call the systemic logic. So these calls of the Occupy movements against inequality, the calls of the 99% against the privileges of the 1%, calls against austerity, calls for women's equality with men on the labor market. These are very valid, very important calls for equality within certain model of well-being. But what we need and what it's time, and I believe it's really, we have the means to do it now, if more than any time before, is to question the whole model of well-being. We're ready.
You've written that a solution to the constellation of problems you've outlined might come in the form of what you call a political economy of trust. What do you mean by that term?
Right. So companies are not investing because they're insecure. People are not spending because they're insecure. So everybody is working more because they are uncertain they might have a job tomorrow. So what we need to do is to have another safety net, but I don't believe that that safety net should come through, although I'm not opposed to, a redistribution. We need to throw a new safety net, for instance, starting with the nationalization or bringing back into public hands those companies which cannot be properly exposed to competition. Companies which exploit rent don't belong to capitalism. This is against the very logic of capitalist competition. So,
And by rent, you mean profits from investments?
Profits from investment without proper exposure to risk, because such as big banks, gas and electricity, railways, everything that is deemed essential for society is a public utility, and it should go into public hands. At the same time, allowing free competition on a smaller scale, of course, for people to be able to express their creativity in the production process if they so wish. At the same time, it is very important that the social safety net, that is unemployment, then minimal, some sort of minimal income, is not linked to your participation in the labor market. For instance, the way it is done in the Nordic countries of Europe, where social provision is not predicated on the employment contract like in Germany, but is predicated on national citizenship. So I propose that social provision, social safety is based on European denizenship. I'm not using the word citizenship because a lot of people live in Europe without being citizens, but on European denizenship. Then people would have the safety to dream big, and the companies would have the security of investing and venturing into the risks they have to take in order to make the economy prosperous. So we could be setting up what I've proposed as European Sovereign Wealth Fund. Those companies who are in public hands would be run in a competitive way in the global economy, but the profits should go back in order to fill up this social safety fund that would provide the safety net to people.
Is what you're suggesting a break from capitalism?
It would be a break from capitalism in the sense that if capitalism is defined as the competitive production of profit, and that mechanism is supposed to also provide social integration, then it is a break from capitalism, because this would be substantial stepping away from the competitive production of profit. People's lives would not depend on that, and the market would not be playing the role of social integration.
So, Albana, your focus is, of course, Europe. You're based in Brussels. There's a lot of hand-wringing about the rise of Euro-skeptic parties in Europe, seen, for example, in the by how well these parties did in the last elections for the European Parliament. How alarmed are you by the rise of these formations and by the success of a lot of these fringe parties in the political landscape?
Well, in some ways I celebrate the rise of these parties because they're bringing alternatives. They're challenging the status quo. They're bringing back to us the awareness that we're entitled to a right to politics, to a right of contestation and alternatives. Moreover, in my reading, these parties, what I mean is these new populist, extreme left, extreme right parties that have been rejected as being non-democratic, especially because of their xenophobia, this is simply the wrong politicization of a very important grievance, is that current economic policy is taking people's lives away. So my hope is that these parties might pressure the center-left and the center-right establishment to do something serious about addressing the concerns of these people. Unfortunately, what the center-left and center-right are doing are taking that discourse, the xenophobic discourse, and mainstreaming it. Remember that a slogan of the British Prime Minister, the Labour Prime Minister, British jobs for British workers. This is exactly mainstreaming the economic xenophobia that is being brought up by this frustrated electorate of the extreme left and extreme right, which I see as mobilizing around a new poll, the risk poll. And they're taking that discourse in a very dangerous way, in being mainstreaming it in the policies of the center-left and center-right establishment, which are forming another pole, which I call the opportunity pole, because the center-left and the center-right and the green have been united behind this feeling, this perception of globalization as bringing more opportunities than risks. But no, their opponents now are people who are experiencing the risks side of the opportunity risk divide.
Albena Asmanova, she is associate professor in social and political thought at the University of Kent at Brussels, Belgium. We've put links on againstofthegrain.org to her book, The Scandal of Reason, as well as to her co-edited volume, Reclaiming Democracy. Thanks, Albena, so much for joining me.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting, as Albert Einstein once did, that the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.